The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
So the young guy on it, that was on the under-20s last year, he turned it up to me halfway through the game because you're too old. I was like,
he was back. You're his coach.
Tell me you dropped him.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
And Ed Walsh's interview afterwards is one of the highlights of the games, I have to say, for me so far. Brilliant.
Yeah, that's one of the key things, is that himself and Michaela, just even if you just keep it to that family just for a moment, are two of the most likeable Olympians Ireland have ever had. And then you throw Kelly Harrington into the mix as well, and you're just rooting for her at every step of the way. Like, I think Harrington, almost in her post-fight interview, there is a temptation to try and get her to speak about the real medal hopes that she has and how far she can go into this tournament. And she's got no interest in talking about it whatsoever. I'm not sure, is it the delay to the games maybe? Is it due to the fact that she's had to wait so long, even before the delay to this game, to actually be a representative for Ireland? But God, she is in the zone right now. She has no interest in any distraction whatsoever, and even entertaining the possibility of talking about a medal bout or any of that nonsense right now. She is here and is trusting the process, to use that phrase, at the moment, and she's totally dialed in.
Yeah, and that's the way to do it. And you're absolutely right. Like, looking at it last night, she had obviously got a buy into the round of 16. She had seen some of her main competitors, including, you mentioned, Dubois there. And I read a piece with her in The Guardian during the week. And really, somebody who Kelly Harrington has beaten really recently in the European qualifiers, but somebody who has really big hopes here as well, and like much younger than Kelly Harrington, let's say. But yeah, certainly, like, people who haven't seen the fight last night might be sort of waiting to catch up with her. It was just, she was really dominant throughout, wasn't she? She controlled each round, was always ahead in the scorecards. It was one of those that was never really in doubt. Like, I know Aidan Walsh towards the end of his fight was, they were, the commentator was saying that, you know, the referee was kind of giving him a bit of a finger wagging as to stop running around the ring necessarily. Like, looking at your head and there's medals on the line, you're going to do whatever the hell it is to get you over the line. But no, not with Kelly. She was really controlled. So we'll see. Like, there's just big few days to come. And the boxing team particularly, like, I remember over the previous few Olympics on, like, the team, we obviously had big teams in, they would progress. And as it was, like, they almost progressed in a very linear fashion, in that, like, you know, you've had six going through and then one or two would get knocked out, and then three or four would advance and one or two more would get knocked out. And it kind of followed that pattern. But this game has been a little bit different in that we've had, you know, a big amount of fighters exiting early on, but it does look as if the cream is rising to the top, hopefully, over the next few days.
Absolutely, and we've had the athletics up and running as well overnight. We're going to be joined by Cathal Dennehy from the Olympic Stadium in Tokyo very shortly indeed. But the main news really there is that Ireland's three hopes in the 800 metres all failed to get out of their heats. It was always going to be an incredibly difficult task for all three of them. I think the most disappointed out of the three of them would have been Nadia Power, because she ran a little bit off her own personal best, and you could tell in her interview on television afterwards that she was disappointed. Now, in fairness, herself, Louise Shanahan and Shifra Cleary-Butner all did well to be there and are all kind of bolters when it came to this team, certainly in the context of the games being pushed back and the games happening in 2021. So their eyes will certainly be on bigger things at the next games. But even within the context of this, I think you could tell from Power's reaction afterwards that she was there to compete and there to try and qualify, and she fell short of that. Tom Bardo showed up. He was in the lane right beside Carson Warholm for his 400 metre hurdles heat, which is an unenviable position to be in. We'll get Dennehy's take on that about, well, actually, is that an unenviable position to be in? Because, you know, he's going to be the guy setting the pace anyway, and once you're on his shoulder to a certain degree, you know you're going to power through. But he had to kick on quite a bit in the last 100 metres to ensure that he got second place in his heat to get a good draw for the semi-finals, and he'll go again in that. But it's an unbelievably stacked event, the 400 metre hurdles, and getting to a final from Tom Barr's perspective will be a really good result. In the sailing then, just to move it away from the athletics, Annalise Murphy finished 40th in race 10 in the laser radial. So as you can imagine, that is not going to be good enough to get her into position in the medal race. She has finished 18th overall, the top 10 get into the medal race. So I think Annalise's poor start and that unfortunate kind of tangling with the Fijian boat on day one has ultimately cost her, because she had a brilliant day yesterday, and maybe if she'd started better and finished better and with a bit more fortune, she could have made it into the medal race. And then the 49ers, Rob Dixon and Sean Waddilove, were 9th in race 9 and 14th overall. They have 3 races tomorrow now, and they'll be doing the exact same thing, try and make it into the top 10 and try and make it into the business end of things there. The other thing overnight that a lot of Irish eyes will have been on was the hockey, Ireland against India. India won the game 1-0 and probably deservedly so. They could have been in the lead at half time. Aisha McFerrin, the true possibly world-class player that Ireland have, was the saviour once again. She kept the score down against the Dutch a few days ago and she was brilliant again in the first half, but India did find their winner in the second half, and Ireland will now need to beat Team GB tomorrow to get through to the next round, which is what you want, Adrian. You want just those high stakes and a little bit of magic dust on that event tomorrow. May as well lose to India tomorrow to ensure that Team GB game is a do-or-die game.
Yeah, we'll see. Like, it's been actually, even when you mentioned the sailing there, it's been a tough, it's been, not been a great games for the viewer at this end of the world. And I know that some of the athletics obviously will slip into a point where people might actually be out of the scratcher and won't have to get up in the middle of the night. But like, I remember the way that we followed Annalise, for example, at the previous games, and you knew it inside out. We were joking about it at the start of the Olympics that you knew about the upwind and the downwind, and she should have taken the lee side or whatever it would have been. And it's just, we haven't had that same investment, and we're not, it looks like maybe going to have it now from that performance last night. She's been, I mean, I'd be interested to hear from her afterwards and get her take on it and technically why it all fell the way it did. But she's been, like, from the highs of finishing in the top five across a couple of races to been right out of the mix. It must be an incredibly tough, it must have been incredibly tough games for her. And the golf as well, on the lads have wrapped up there just in the last, well, Lowry's actually playing the 18th, but McIlroy's, following Rory McIlroy is, when you're invested in wanting to do well, is a tough thing to do, and it has been across his career when you're standing over putts that you think he should be getting and he's just not nailing them. And it's been kind of the case for him again this morning, but he, including a bogey now on the 18th, he had been one of the best rounds of the day, and it still is on 500 par, the 66, but he's home on 700, and that's 3 back now from the Mexican leader, and Lowry's on the same score playing the last. So look at their two of them very much in the mix. And like, you know, if they're in the melting pot come Championship Sunday on or whatever it is that I presume they, it'll follow the same type of schedule, will it? That, you know, I presume if I'm a golfer, if I'm part of that committee, I'm like, listen, follow the same schedule. So it will take on, that will totally take on a life of its own, won't it, come Sunday then, if the two lads are in the mix, and suddenly a sport that we didn't, I mean, did we really care about it that much until the two lads are in the mix? Suddenly we've all got our tricolours out and we're going for it on Sunday.
I'm not going to lie, the golf at Rio 2016 didn't really move the needle for me whatsoever. But things are different now. I think golf as a game has just got more popular over the last 5 years. I think that's it. It's just a more important sport.
And I thought you were going to say over the last 5 hours.
Yeah, over the last 5 hours as well. I think when it comes to the Olympic movement, I think in those five rings, I think we can find a golfer's heart in there somewhere. And I think that the medals will be worth a lot more this year than they were in Rio. And I think if we happen to have an Irish winner at the end of the week, then so be it. I'm personally looking forward to Rory McIlroy winning gold and running around Tokyo with a tricolour around his neck with rebel songs playing and revealing himself as a true Irish patriot as things go on. But it could be himself or Lowry. They're both very very close in those scores at the moment. So we'll keep you up to speed on that as they come home, and Lowry just about to finish off there. One thing we should mention as well from last night, a brilliant win for Bowes beating Doodlelange 3-0, and to stay progressive the next round to play Pauk. Gavin Comiskey, the Irish Times, writing here that Pauk just beat Feyenoord 2-1 in a pre-season friendly, so the standard goes right up. But a brilliant moment for them once again last night at the Aviva Stadium, and brilliant financially obviously for them, progressing through the rounds in the Conference League. Adrian, I just do want to tee you up here for something by running through some of the front pages and leads and the sports pages this morning, because I guess the papers are kind of running 24 hours behind, more than 24 hours behind really, reacting to yesterday morning's results in Tokyo, which is of course Fintan McCarthy and Paul O'Donovan winning gold. There is the front of the Irish Times sports section: Ireland's rowing revolution strikes gold in land of the rising sun. We've got the Irish Sun next up. Skibbereen, white and gold is their front page headline. Cork pair row to Olympic win. First Irish top spot since 2012. And all row shade of Vahawalia. Fintan Paul as good as gold is the back page. The Mirror, meanwhile, their front page is rowing for gold. Historic day as pair win at Tokyo Games. The back page is row stopping us now. The Irish Star, meanwhile, black gold, they'll row through Porter and Skibbereen, laughs medal champ. That's the front of the Irish Daily Star. And we want more, we owe you I, as they're talking about Paris and the next Olympics already. The Irish Daily Mail front page, it's talking about HSE and the jabs as good news one. But good news two is our golden boys row into Olympic history. And the back page is pride of a nation. As you can see, there's plenty of Rassi Erasmus stuff in the sports pages as well this morning, which we'll get to a little bit later on. The Herald goes with rowing heroes already making plans for Paris. We have a copy of The Echo here as well, which, as you can imagine, is going big in it. Skibbereen, white and gold. The Irish Examiner then go with golden boys, and they've got a nice little spread on the front of their sports section. Olympic champions McCarthy and O'Donovan rewrite rowing history, and there is the front of the Irish Examiner this morning. Skib erupts in green, white and gold. Adrian, I think you're putting these guys on a real pedestal, especially Paul O'Donovan. I think you're, as I watch Shane Lowry tap in there on the 18th, you're putting him almost above Shane Lowry as one of the most likeable Irish sports people currently playing.
It got us thinking yesterday about who exactly is when we watched Paul O'Donovan and the success he's had and where he stands now in the great sort of Olympians of all time. And he is absolutely right up there now. And, you know, and how likable he is. And so you tie all those things together. And we've just been talking about Kelly Harrington and Aidan Walsh, who certainly ticked that box as well. But it got us wondering about who exactly it is that's Ireland's most loved active sports person. So it's a, you know, there's a nicheness to the polo, but we stuck it up. And like, we were thinking when we shut off a few names yesterday, and it was the four names we put up in the poll here, he was obviously one of them. Shane Lowry is up there. Keddie Taylor obviously is up there. Seamus Coleman is up there as well. So they were the four names we went for, and I'll give you a bit of a flavor of some of the other names that came in yesterday when we went at it as well. But as you can see, it's Shane Lowry really who's dominating it here, and he's over 50% of the vote. Then you've Katie on about a quarter of the vote, and then it's kind of split between Paul O'Donovan and Seamus Coleman, who's bringing up the rear on it. But yeah, that's the way it goes, and I mean, it's a good snapshot. There's about 1,000 people who voted on it so far, and we'll keep the poll running over the course of the day. So anybody who's tuned in and wants to get involved, jump on there and cast your vote. It looks like Lowry has sort of won the day. There was a few other people as well that we got into. Kelly Harrington certainly in the mix. Joe Canning is probably in the mix as well, and it's not really a thing that lends itself that well to a GAA player in the parochial nature of GAA players, that, you know, if you're very good for Galway, then you're probably hated by Kilkenny and Clare and a few more as well. But I think Joe Canning is probably in the mix, and particularly for the week that's in it. Tommy Walsh talking during the week saying that he's universally loved, so that'll do for me. Padraig Harrington obviously is in there. Rory was certainly a name that came up when we put it out last night. It's incredible that he still divides opinion, that we can't all just get behind a guy who is really good at golf and lives up the road. But look at, there we go. He definitely needs to be on that extended list. Aisha McFerrin, World Cup hero. Keane Lynch probably deserves a shout there. Mick Conlon, Tig Furlong, Rachel Blackmore, one of the other names that's mentioned. So look, there is an extensive list there, but I think those four, Katie, Lowry, Paul O'Donovan and Seamus Coleman, were probably the four that came through. Tough to pick between them on. What's your order?
Ooh, it's a tough one. Like, I do think that when we did the sports moments of the decade in 2019, wasn't it, at the end of the decade, Shane Lowry actually beat Katie Taylor in the final of Ireland's greatest sports moment of the decade, which I wasn't surprised about at the time. There was probably a recency bias, given he had just won the Claret Jug in 2019. But I do think that there is just this general love for Shane Lowry, which is unmatched by anybody else in Ireland. And I think that if Shane Lowry were to win gold here, for example, this weekend, I think that would be heralded as right up there with maybe not right up there with the Claret Jug, because it's not as big a deal in the golf world as Claret Jug, but it would be the moment of these games, really, wouldn't it, if he were to do that. And it's no disrespect to anybody else in that poll. I think they're all absolute heroes at this stage of the Irish sporting public, but I just think Shane Lowry is just the hero, really.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think I'm surprised actually that Katie is so far behind, because like somebody who changed the face of a sport and actually changed the face of women's sport in this country, nobody has a bad word to say about her. She touches people from 5 to 105. She's very charismatic when you meet her, and I think I am actually surprised that she's not further up the list on, to be honest with you, because of everything that she's achieved. I think that, like, I know that she says herself about the stuff that she's achieved after 2012, but I do think that that's the headline of her career, to be honest with you. Like, the fact that she was responsible, let's call it as it is, for having the sport in the Olympics to begin with, and then to go on and win it. So I think that that's certainly the big appeal around Katie. But like with Shane Lowry, he's you, you're him. That's the Lowry appeal for me. Like, he came from nowhere, obviously, in the Irish Open. We all felt a part of that win then. We feel a part of him now. There's definitely that everyman aspect to him. And I can certainly see why he's topping the poll in that way. But Paul O'Donovan probably suffers on, because we only see him once every 4 years, really. Like, I know with the Worlds and stuff, he tends to pierce the consciousness, but I think that's probably a reason behind that. And Seamus Coleman benefits, conversely, from not having gone to United or Liverpool, because then he doesn't cop the hate from everybody else. So good, he benefits point. Probably from staying at Everton.
So people can still vote on your profile, Adrian?
Yeah, hop on there, and we'll keep the poll rolling till this evening, probably.
Okay, we are going to Tokyo in just a moment. It is 7:47 on this Friday morning. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Let's have a look at what's coming up over the course of the next couple of hours. Irish Athletics in the company of Cathal Dennehy coming your way in just a moment. We'll be chatting about the boxers overnight as well. Aidan Walsh securing a bronze medal at least. Kelly Harrington progressing in comprehensive fashion. Ronan Mullen will be with us to analyse both of those fights. And look ahead as well to Kurt Walker, who, let's not forget, is fighting on Sunday morning for a bit of a super Sunday at the Olympic Games. Olympics latest then, Will O'Callaghan coming your way at 8:20. Anything you might have missed, he'll be bringing you up to speed. Our GAA quick picks are coming up then at 8:30 as we look ahead to four massive fixtures across both codes this weekend. Alan Quinlan will be with us to talk about Reply Guy Razzie and plenty more besides ahead of the second test in the Lions Tour at 8:40. A crappy quiz coming your way at 9:10, and then John Giles in conversation with Nathan is coming your way at 9:30. So that is the menu set for you this morning. Rory McIlroy, as you mentioned, comes off the course with a 66. Shane Lowry comes off the course with a 65. They're both on 7 under par, Adrian, I think, as they move into round 3. Their leaderboard is starting to get a little bit more stacked as well. You're seeing the likes of Hideki Matsuyama and Colin Morikawa making moves today.
Would love to have seen McIlroy just hang on for that par on the 18th. On that, you're hoping now almost that Carlos Ortiz comes back to the pack a little bit. You know that you don't want to be tomorrow. He's already in the clubhouse today with a brilliant round of 65. But you'd like to have seen McIlroy maybe a little bit closer. But look, you'd always say with him, if he's within touching distance, he's got a shout. And we'll be more interested now than we were when today started out. That's for sure.
What else are you looking forward to this weekend?
That's probably going to be right up there. I'm looking forward to seeing the fact that the athletics have now kicked off. So I'm looking forward to, like, there is definitely something a bit more special, and we'll talk to Carl about when he's on, but there's definitely something a bit more special, I think, about the Olympics when it becomes less fragmented, in that it's not at 100 venues anymore. It's all getting very sort of, the circle starts to close in on the main venue, and I think that there's something a bit more special about that. So looking forward to getting to that.
We can go to the main venue right now. Cathal Dennehy, good evening to you. How are you keeping?
Very good. It's absolutely lashing rain as of the last 45 minutes in Tokyo, so it feels very Irish here in the stadium.
Because on the television coverage this morning, it looked as if a certain section of Tokyo was getting drenched, and everybody was talking about maybe like great humidity in the stadium, and not only that, but this incredibly fast track that was going to be conducive to amazing times and perhaps records tumbling left, right and centre.
Yeah, it's definitely a very fast track. We've seen evidence that this morning, Marie-Jose Talou of the Ivory Coast in the women's 100-metre heats, she ran 10.78. Elaine Thompson of Jamaica, the reigning Olympic champion, ran, I think it was 10.82, and she was jogging. I mean, there's athletes, certainly spikes and new footwear technology is playing a role, but there's no doubt that this is a fast track. And generally, I mean, 90% of the time here, the weather has been ideal for sprinters. They love it warm. Distance runners, not so much with the humidity, but it's perfect for fast running. I think we're going to see some lightning times over the next 2 days as those 100-metre finals get going.
Let's talk about Tom Barr. Were there any nerves on your part watching him come home and on that home stretch? I guess he was helped a little bit by knowing that Warholm was right beside him.
Yeah, I think he was. I think some of us in the press tribune, I suppose, were a little bit skeptical, I guess, as he was going around the last bend. He was back in about fourth. But he explained afterwards that basically he'd had a chat with Warholm, the A-list star of his events, the alpha, I suppose, of the 400 metre hurdles, the world record holder. And Warholm was one lane outside him. And he told him in the warm up, look, I'm going to go out easy. I'm not going to go too hard. You know, it was first four out of eight to go through automatically. So it was very kind of soft, I suppose, qualification criteria. Wasn't really going to be at risk. And I think perhaps what lulls Thomas into a bit of a false sense of security was that Warholm, he said to us afterwards, he was like, Warholm going out slow was probably still my fast. So he assumed he was probably going a bit quicker than he actually was going through that first 200. And then as he came around the last bend, that he got a bit of a fright when he saw two guys come up on the lanes inside him. And then suddenly he realized he was in fourth. So he said, I better put the hammer down. But as always with Thomas, once he does put that hammer down in the last 100, there's very few people like him in the world who finish as well as him over the last 50. And he moved from fourth up to second, automatic qualifier. And also what helps is it gets him a good lane for the semi-final. He was quite pleased with it. The time was nothing special for him. Not bad, not particularly good, 49.02. He's run 48.39 already this year. But, you know, early morning, first time in the stadium, drowned in sweat with the humidity and the heat that was here this morning before the rain broke. I think he'd be quite pleased with it. And I was saying to him afterwards, like, you know, just looking back on two of his best championships, the Europeans in 2018, the Olympics in 2016. From his first round to his second round, he took off about 7/10 of a second both times. Now, doing that again before Sunday's semi-final will put him at about 48.3, 48.4 if he can find that improvement again. He's going to need to be honest, because the semi-final draw is already out. He's in against Carsten Warholm. He's in against Ry Benjamin. In my mind, if they don't fall over, they're going to be the gold and silver medalists. And there's three semi-finals. So he has really got the bum draw here, because only the top two go through. So I think unless something happens to Benjamin or Warholm, he's going to be running for third place in that heat, or fourth place. And it's going to be all about the clock. And I think he knows himself it's going to have to be low 48 seconds, perhaps even high 47 seconds. His national record is 47.97, and that he's going to have to come pretty close to that to get into the final.
Right, so he's right up against it. I was going to ask you if Samba was going to be a contender for the gold or silver, because we actually didn't get to see him perform because Kelly Harrington was on TV earlier on at that same time. So you're writing him out of the gold and silver medal contention, Samba.
I am. He was the alpha dog, I suppose, about 2 years ago, or right. 2018, I think, was his best year. And since then, I guess he's had a few injury problems. It's basically Warholm and Benjamin for gold and silver. And the Brazilian young guy, I think he's only 21 years old, Alisson dos Santos. He's really, really impressive this year. He's third fastest so far this year. Again, is running low 47 seconds. So much can go wrong in the 400 meter hurdles. Thomas realized that very quickly in Oslo the last time he smacked the first hurdle and fell. So there's so much room for calamity that it's all about just getting into that eight-man final. I mean, in Rio, he made the eight-man final and a guy false-started one of the big contenders in the final. So suddenly down to seven men, then you get a disqualification, you get someone hitting a hurdle. You never know what can happen, but it's going to be, he's going to need the race of his life on Sunday afternoon. Or I think it's Sunday evening Irish time, Sunday evening Tokyo time, Sunday afternoon Irish time.
Are you confident that that's going to come for him?
I think it's about 50-50.
Right.
In fact, I'd say if you were a bookmaker looking at it, you'd probably say it's more 40% chance. I think there's probably, like, he's, unless a miracle happens with Warholm and Benjamin, he's not going to make the top two in his semi-final. So you're talking about two fastest loser spots or time qualifiers to go across three heats of 24 athletes. And I think there's probably 6 to 7 to 8 athletes equally as strong as Thomas here. So you're talking about 8 athletes or so competing for 2-time qualifier spots. So it really is cutthroat. If he got an easier heat draw, he could have competed for that first or second place in the heat. He's unfortunately in with the Uber champions, two of the fastest men of all time. I think he's fastest man of all time and the third fastest man of all time in history. And he's unfortunately in against him in an Olympic semi-final. So like we said, he's really, really up against it. But again, he's a championship performer. He said he has lots more in the tank and he felt good out there today. So I'd expect to see him go much, much quicker on Sunday.
You're really managing our expectations here, Carl, I have to say, in that I don't feel that confident now listening to you. But come here, look, is it a different, how different of a race is it for Tom Barr if he's effectively running against the clock? You're saying he's not really racing against his opponents here, he's running against the clock.
Yeah, I guess the 400 hurdles is always that game because of their stride pattern. You know, Thomas takes 13 strides between the hurdles, I think it is, up to hurdle 6 or hurdle 7. And, you know, that's something that's been rehearsed so many times his whole life. He's been doing this now for over 10 years. He's been running this event. So as he said himself to me recently, he's like, I could run the first 5 hurdles with my eyes closed. You know, the stride pattern is that set. So it really is about staying in your lane. But at the same time, what can so often happen is that you can get thrown off. In his semi-final, he's in lane 4, and I think Warhump's in lane 3 on Sunday. So what he's going to see once he gets to that first hurdle, because Warhump goes out like an absolute bat out of hell. Now, he took it easy this morning. He is not going to take it easy in his semi-final. He's going to be trying to lay down a statement because he'll have 2 days rest before the final, and he's in against the other big contender for gold. So I think Thomas is going to see Carsten Warhump come up on a lane inside him after about 50 metres, and the key is then really not to panic, to be aware that will happen and to just run his own race. Like we said, it's more than likely going to be a race with 4 or 5 other men to get that third place, to get that fourth place, and then to check the clock and just hope for the best. But like I said, I wouldn't be hugely confident he can do it, but I would certainly not be betting that he wouldn't do it at the same time, because we've seen time and time again, once Thomas gets on the big stage, and he, of course, with no fans here, it doesn't really feel like the big stage, even if it's a beautiful, massive stadium. But once he does get into high-pressure situations, he tends to thrive. So I think a lot of people will be waking up on Sunday morning and hope he does the same again.
Yeah, it's going to be an unbelievable couple of days in that event. Just to go through some of the 800 metres, then I guess Nadia Power on the post-race interviews on television came across as the most disappointed.
Yeah, Nadia was certainly, you could see maybe devastation's too strong a word, but it's certainly huge disappointment. Again, it was only later, probably when we were chatting to her, that she did mention that she was sick last week at the holding camp. She spent a few days in bed. And then she immediately followed that up with, I don't want to use it as an excuse because it's not an excuse. I felt better by the end of last week. I think it was good to see that, you know, she was like, look, maybe mentally it threw me off, but she said physically I was back to normal. I had no reason not to run my best out there. She didn't run her best. There's no point pretending. I mean, you know, sometimes I think even on Twitter there last night, I said about one of the rowers underperforming, and like Philip Doyle and Salita, and people took offense to that, the statement of underperforming. But I, as I said back to someone, if you don't say that these athletes underperform when they do underperform, then it's insulting their ability, because, you know, Nadia is not an athlete who's running 203.7 if she gets it right. She's an athlete who's running 201, maybe 2 minutes. Same with Chief Claire Butner, who ran 204.6 today. She's an athlete who should be running around 201, certainly 202, and that's the expectation she would have set for herself. And to fall 2 to 3 seconds short of what they probably thought they should be running today, there's no doubt that all three of the 800-metre girls are going to walk away disappointed. I think specifically Nadia and Shifra. They, in fairness to them, they gave it a go. They did everything right. They went through into the bell in about halfway in about 59, 60 seconds, got to 600 metres in 130. They tried their best to keep up with the best women in the world. But there's really, sometimes it's just there's no reason for it. You know, they gave it their all. They got to 650 and then the tank just ran dry, really. And they had very long last 100 metres trying to get to the line. But that, maybe they could have paced it a bit better. Maybe they could have gone off a bit easier. But then you're essentially saying, in that scenario, I have 0% chance of qualifying. I'm not even going to try to qualify and make the top three. And they didn't do that. They gave it a go. It didn't work out. Sometimes it's just a question of talent. Sometimes for them, it's a case of, I guess, progression in their career. They're not quite strong enough to keep up. They don't have the years of training that some of their rivals do. And I think we will see a lot of these girls. They're young enough. We will see them back at World Championships next year in Eugene, over in Oregon. We'll see them at Europeans in Munich next year. And we'll certainly see a lot of them back in Munich. And I think for the experience, for this weird pandemic games experience, it's been, they'll all be the better for it.
How much of it is going to come down to, in those future meets that you talk about, just to learning the street smarts and learning almost what this level is like? I mean, it's, there was a couple of unfortunate moments maybe in Shifra's race where she kind of clipped an opponent's heel, I think actually twice in the race, and maybe just with a bit more of an aggressive race position, which probably comes with confidence, that doesn't happen in future?
Yeah, I think that certainly you know, it's something that has happened to Shifra a few times, both today and at the European indoors. She was kind of almost running into the back of people. And I guess it was surprising for her because she is a product, I guess, of the NCAA system. She went to Villanova University. And if there's one thing that teaches you, it's race craft. You know, you're in against so many athletes who are better than you. You're racing, you know, I don't know, probably 20 times a year you might be racing. So you really do learn how to maneuver around the pack. Shifra today, maybe it wasn't her fault. I just saw those stumble moments like you mentioned. I'm not sure how at fault she was for them, but it's certainly, you know, when you're in a situation like she was in where, you know, even if maybe you run your best, you might only get fifth or sixth. You really do have to do everything right to have any shot of being competitive. And unfortunately, you know, those little errors, that little quarter second or half second they might have cost her, ultimately they were the death knell for her chances.
And when it came to what Nadia Power was talking about afterwards, she just said she felt she didn't really have the legs at a certain point. And I guess, does that come down to almost not knowing where you're at until you actually race at a level like this? And I guess when it comes to Paris and all the big meets between now and then, she will have had the experience of the legs going or the legs not being available to her and kind of knowing how to manoeuvre that situation in future.
I think so, yeah. I think she, like, I think people have to remember, I suppose, with Nadia, that this is essentially her first year as a real full-fledged senior. Like, she won a European under 23 medal 2 years ago, and obviously pandemic paid to everything last year. And then she came out earlier on this year. She ran 2:00.9 to break the national indoor record that was quickly broken by Shifra over 800. And she got so much well-deserved, I guess, exposure for that and attention for that and praise for that. And it was a brilliant breakthrough. But I think ever since, for whatever reason, and I'm sure probably Nadia and her coach, Enda Fitzpatrick, are probably the only people who really know it, she just hasn't quite been able to hit the same level outdoor. That sort of 2:01, 2 minutes kind of times that she was able to do indoors. And I think they'll probably learn a lot from it, though. And I think what we're probably seeing with some of those 800 meter women was that the new qualifying system probably just took the edge off a lot of them. Nadia had been pretty safe ever since March, but not entirely safe under the ranking system to qualify. Chief for Clary Butner was very much not safe. Same for Louise Shanahan, who only qualified on the last weekend. They had to go running around Europe throughout May and June to try and get their qualifiers under that world ranking system. And I think by the time they got here, I wouldn't say it like a case that they were cooked, but certainly if you're preparing to peak on a championship, ideally you wouldn't be traversing Europe, I suppose, for most of May and June. But again, they didn't have much choice. If they wanted to be at the games, that's what they had to do. And I suppose on a positive note as well, I mean, Louise Shanahan is, you know, she wasn't happy with her time. She ran 2:03. She was probably a lot closer to the field than Nadia and Shifra were, but she came through. And I mean, what a breakthrough it's been for her this year. She ran 2:01 indoors. She wasn't going to be going to the games all along. And then pulled it out of the fire on the weekend of national championships. She won nationals, got big bonus points there, and then she went to Lucerne 3 days later and ran a time quick enough to just sneak in on the rankings. And, you know, she came through today, and I think she was a great example, Louise, of, you know, it doesn't always have to be about qualifying or even running personal best sometimes. And I'd be hesitant to say, you know, that they're happy to be here, but in some cases, an athlete as young as her and as progressive as her should walk off the track. And even if they finish seventh, they should be smiling as she was and be extremely proud, knowing that this wasn't even on the radar 6 months ago. And now she's an Olympian. As she said, if the worst thing that happens today is that I became an Olympian, so be it. You know, that's a pretty good day. And I think now it'll be great to watch them looking towards Europeans next year. I mean, the Brits, like, people, they have a couple of athletes now running in the 156s, 157s. They've taken it up such a high level. But there's no reason that all three of those girls who ran the 800 metres today can't be looking towards the Europeans next year and saying, I can be in the 800 metre final, and looking towards the World Championships and saying, I can make the World Championships semi-final. And then maybe thinking 3 years down the line, can I possibly get good enough to make an Olympic final? And they'll have learned a lot today.
For sure. The one other event that kind of caught our eye just watching on television this morning, Cathal, were the heats for the women's 100 metres. I mean, over 100 and over 200. I think we're set to have some unbelievable battles over the next couple of days. We saw Dina Asher-Smith's first run out, for example, slightly beaten narrowly in her heat. Who impressed most across the heats for their 100? Because we only got a few of them on TV.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Marie-Jose Talou of the Ivory Coast was really impressive, 10:78, which is just an astonishing time. But I think the big comeback for me was probably Elaine Thompson-Herah, the 2016 Olympic champion from Jamaica in the 100 metres. She she was kind of always second fiddle until 2016 behind Shelley Ann Fraser-Pryce. Now, it's going to be a really interesting final. I don't think the final is at 1:50 p.m. Irish time tomorrow, so it's a nice, friendly, I suppose, sociable time for all the Irish people who've been staying up half the night. And again, the men's final is lunchtime on Sunday as well at the same time. So it'll be a good, those kind of blue ribbon events of the games to not have to get up in the middle of the night to watch them. But I think it's going to come down to, despite what Talu ran today of the Ivory Coast, I think it's going to be a Jamaican head-to-head. It's going to be the sprint queen, the two-time Olympic champion, I think four-time world champion, Shelley-Ann Fraser-Pryce, versus the reigning Olympic champion, Elaine Thompson. I don't know who's going to win. The one thing I know for sure is that Shelley-Ann Fraser-Pryce is going to lead to halfway. She has, they call her Mommy Rocket. She's the mother of a child as well. And she absolutely rockets out of the blocks. There is no one in the world, there's no one in history who has ever, no female sprinter who's ever started like Shelley-Ann Fraser-Pryce. She'll be in front after 30 or 40 meters, but then Elaine Thompson has the better finish. She has the better last 40, 50. She'll be mowing her down. And to be honest, I have no idea who's going to win. I suspect, just going off championship calibre, that it'll be Shelley-Ann Fraser-Pryce, but that'll be a cracking, cracking race to watch. And to be honest, I think it's actually the race I'm probably looking forward to a lot more than the men's 100 metres, even though the men's generally gets the most hype. But in the post-Bolt era, we don't have that kind of A-list star. Trayvon Bromell will probably win the men's 100 metres. Again, like Shelley-Ann Fraser-Pryce, got the best start, can bring it home and has some championship pedigree. But I think in the women's 100 metres, you have those two truly all-time greats of the event in Elaine Thompson and Shelley-Ann Fraser-Pryce going head-to-head. And then you have people like Dina Asher-Smith, Britain's golden girl, of course, and then Talu coming out of nowhere as well. So that's going to be a hell of a dust-up for the medals.
Yeah, it's going to be a brilliant couple of days. What is it like in the stadium, Cathal? I presume it's fairly impressive.
It's very impressive. It's beautiful. Thankfully, they painted the seats a different colour as I look around here, so it doesn't look like it's as empty as it is. But I think the silence is still quite eerie. You know, even talking to some of the people from World Athletics yesterday in the media centre, a lot of them were kind of saying that, you know, like the swimming has kind of got away with a little bit of an atmosphere because athletes are able to go watch. And being an indoor venue, that noise is kind of exacerbated. Obviously, it's open air here, and there's not going to be that. A lot of the athletes who've competed will already have to ship out of the village and ship out of Tokyo within 24 or 48 hours. So there's not going to be that many athletes here. And obviously there's no cheering in the press box. So there's not going to be much of a cheering or much of an atmosphere. And Thomas Barr kind of said he came out this morning and it felt a bit weird. And he was looking around just to try and find an Irish face. And it was actually the photographer, Brian Keane, was the one he saw. So he was like, right, at least I've seen one Irish person. It kind of feels more like a familiar championship setting. But it is strange. I don't know. I was saying to some of the journalists, they need to like pump up the soundtrack or something, because it just feels kind of wrong almost on the athletes, you know, that this is the thing they've dreamed about for 5 years. And just you get it at national championships and you get it at the Diamond League and stuff, but just when it's the pinnacle of the kind of Olympiad, that 4 year, 5 year cycle that we've had now, you just think, isn't it a kind of a shame that they'll cross the line for the best moment of their careers, for many of them the best moment of their lives, and it'll just be met with a silent soundtrack? It's a pity, but I don't know. We need to, the DJ hopefully can work some heroics in the days to come.
Fingers crossed. Cathal Dennehy, great stuff. Thanks a million.
Cheers. Chat soon.
Cheers. Cathal Dennehy there, athletics writer in Tokyo, live from the Olympic Stadium with us this morning. There is plenty still to come for you here on OTBAM this morning. There is a simmering beef in the build-up to the second test for the British and Irish Lions against South Africa, Rassie Erasmus, and that extraordinary hour-long video released privately, well, sort of privately, publicly, but under a strange username on Vimeo yesterday. We're going to be getting stuck into that. And the match preview, indeed, with Alan Quinlan and our own Stephen Kibsey-Green, our in-house South African man, over the course of the next couple of hours. Next, though, we're reacting to another guaranteed medal for Ireland in the boxing ring.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
You're welcome back. It is 11 minutes past 8 on this Friday morning. This is OTB AM. Owen and Adrian with you right the way through until 10 o'clock this morning. We'll have plenty of British and Irish Lions build up coming your way between now and then. We'll have the crappy quiz, but we have to react to Aidan Walsh's success overnight. Ronan Mullen, you called this during the week that this was going to be a really good shout for an Irish medal, and he has got bronze at least.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And we talk and we put such an importance on the draw, but the draw is only as good as your performances. You have to go in and deliver on a reasonable draw. This was by no means a gimme. He was really impressive in his last fight. This was an altogether trickier one, I would say, just given the style that the Mauritian brought to the table. But he quickly sort of navigated his way in the early going, bit of a battle of the jabs at the start. Then he started to land, and as is Aidan Walsh's wont, he frustrates his opponent to such a degree that they basically can find a route back into the fight. If he gets a lead, you can't claw him back. And just a remarkable story that the Walshes have been one of the takeaways from these Olympic Games. And his story's not over yet. He's gone Olympic semi-final. And if that interview's anything to go by, he's not happy with bronze. He's going to try and upset the number one seed in the semi-final.
It's true what you say about him frustrating his opponents. Like his opponent, Mervyn Clare, this morning, literally punching air at times in that second round when he knew he had to go after it.
Yeah, I think Billy Beane would love Aidan Walsh. This is like the prototype of a money ball boxer where there's like no wasted output, no wasted motion. Every punch he throws is meaningful. There's a purpose behind it. And similarly, as you're alluding to there, his movement around the ring, just he owns the perimeter of the ring. And just as you think that's where he wants to reside, he'll pop in and score a shot in the middle of the ring as well. So you just don't know which way to turn. I know the caliber of opponent's going to step up massively in the next round, but he's after dismissing two very different styles of fighters in the previous round. A very aggressive fighter, which he had to neutralize to the best of his abilities. And he did that, as I was saying, like it was borne out. His frustration was borne out by the fact that his opponent in the last round was docked 2 points. And similarly in this one, his opponent was swinging for the fences and just couldn't land. There was probably a little bit, the referee was maybe warning Walsh that he was a little bit overzealous in his moves of evasion, if you want to frame it like that.
It's the referee telling the Italian players against Belgium to stop the time wasting.
Yeah, 100%. I know. And it's such a sprint finish, amateur boxing. And some of the fights at this Olympics have been crazy, like the way they've toed and froed. But I found, for the most part, in the Irish fights, whatever the pattern established in the first couple of minutes tends to define the fight. That's just the way the judges seem to be scoring it. And Aidan Walsh knew with that first round in the bag, and second round was a little bit dicey, but with that one too, by the time it got to the deciding stanza there, he knew it was just a matter of staying on his feet. If he stayed upright, it didn't matter what the judges thought. So just unbelievable. As I think Neil said on Twitter, if it wasn't for Skibbereen and Belfast, we'd be a little bit goosed, but they've delivered massively for us. And as I said, the story's not over yet. And boxing, having come on with Nathan on Monday on a bit of a downer after watching two defeats that morning, we're very much on an upward curve now, I think.
The mornings you're on, and looking at the interview afterwards, it's a brilliant event. But he hasn't seen it, definitely catch up on it today. It'll do your heart an absolute wonder. It's a brilliant thing. But just, he made a really interesting point about the coaching that jumped out to me about the two lads, and it's a bit like being in a computer game and he's just acting out their orders. And we were all so concerned, obviously, after Billy Walsh left, and it's distant past now, but like a word for Zara Antia and John Conlon and what they're doing and their influence on Aidan Walsh and across that team.
Yeah, totally. Like my dealings with Czar, and more specifically with the products of his coaching. So that's everyone from Eric Donovan to Ken Egan. They just sing his praises to the hilt. And while Billy Walsh was like the mastermind, a great facilitator for boxing and pieced everything together, I think when it got down to the granular detail, it was Czar that kind of transformed things in the noughties for Ireland and into this decade as well. So it's going to be very interesting, and I don't want to get too ahead of myself here, but when Kurt Walker's fight hits the TV screens at the weekend and Zor and Billy Walsh go head-to-head, I think everybody, that's almost like a great side attraction. As much as appetizing as that fight's going to be in the ring, I think there'll be a little bit of, I think more so than ever, we'll be listening to those corner instructions in between rounds.
Yeah, well, that's going to be absolutely intriguing. What is it about Zor Antia? Like, technically, you're looking at it to the rest of us who just get carried away with enjoying the event, but you who are into the technical side of it, what is it that he does for them?
I think the best thing he does is he doesn't try and implant his philosophy on the fighter if it doesn't suit them. So like with Aidan Walsh, and you kind of alluded to what he said there in the interview, that he's got the skills to carry out the game plan, which he did, which was box and move, get in and out of range and score, metronomically amateur boxing 101, score, hit and don't get hit. If this was a pro fight, it'd probably be slightly different, but that's what Czar knows. And similarly, the likes of Emmett Brennan, that's not the case. Emmett, though he had been a counterpuncher earlier in his career, is very much a pressure fighter now, and that's what got him to these Olympic Games. So the best thing, and what you can preach to him, is he cuts his cloth accordingly. And that's the best thing about any coach. There have been, and you see it in other countries, where every fighters fight the exact same way. And while that tends to bear fruit in countries such as Cuba, which are, it's a very disciplined format of training, I think what we have is probably a greater array of styles. And that's, I think that's been central to how successful we've been at Olympics, like across the board.
How good is Pat McCormack then, the British opponent that that Aidan Walsh is going to be fighting on Sunday?
Well, I loved Aidan Walsh's interview. We could talk about the interview itself all day, but saying that Pat McCormack is fighting Ireland's Aidan Walsh, and that's the way he has to look at it. Pat McCormack will be, and I feel like I say this every time, a prohibitive favourite going into this fight, just off the resume. He is the number one ranked fighter in this division. I think his role of honour is something crazy. I think medals at Commonwealth Games, world silver medalist, I think 4 medals at European level, 2 golds and 2 silvers. So, you know, just on the basis of that, he will be a favourite. I watched his fight earlier on. He had to come through a bit of hell to get through the fight. He won it comfortably. If you were just looking at the box score, you would think he won routinely, but his Uzbek opponent really put him to the pin of his collar, cut him in the last round. So that is, like, this is amateur boxing. There's only a couple of days recovery. That's not going to be totally cleaned up by the time that fight rolls around. And as we touched on, Zahar Antti is granular in his details, so he'll be certainly looking at that as maybe a target for Walsh. But
Is that the sort of thing, Ronan, just to, sorry to cut across you, just in an amateur fight like that? I mean, if it was the pro game, you'd be saying get in and pick away at it, but just over that short period of time, is that something they can focus on, or is it almost a distraction?
I think it's just trying to engender that sense of panic in a fight, because as I said, it's such a short distance that Pat McCormack is used to winning fights. If he's somehow, like, if that cut reopens in the early going and Aidan Walsh, as he normally does, wins the first round, then there might just, you can just imagine the tables might turn ever so slightly. So while it won't be the basis of their game plan, I think it definitely will be flagged up. Similarly, Kurt Walker, who's I think possibly the hardest draw ever dished out to an Irish boxer, because it's not getting any easier for him, but he was cut over his, I think, his right eye in the first fight and his left eye in his second fight. So he's certainly sporting the wounds of war going into this. If he comes away with a medal, it will be hard earned.
Yeah, personally, anyway, I'm getting great enjoyment out of both Walker and Walsh, but in very different ways. They're very different stylistically, and Walsh will try and frustrate his opponent. Walker will probably be in a literal bloodbath if he's going to come out on top on Sunday morning. Just very quickly on that before we get into Kelly Harrington, are you thinking 2 defeats on Sunday morning, or what way are you looking?
Yeah, I'm so positive about Kurt Walker. Down the years, I just love his style. As you said, he's just brilliant, and he's got gold medal talent. And I would have said, like, in my previews before the tournament, I was thinking if the draw goes his way, he could certainly get to, like, semi-final, final territory. The draw has absolutely not gone his way, and yet he still finds himself knocking on the door. And, like, this, his opponent at the weekend, you'd think after beating the best fighter in the division, quote unquote, that, you know, it's going to open up for him. He's got a former world silver medalist at the weekend, and another, like, I think I was saying to you the other day, that in his first fight, or in the most recent fight against Mirza Khalilov, who's a very much a pressure fighter and played into Kurt Walker's hands a little bit, like, he got in there and counterpunched him beautifully. This is going to be a bit of a fencing match at the weekend, so it's definitely going to be a skills game. And I would back Kurt Walker to beat anybody in a skills game. So we'll see how it goes. If he's got the right temperament, and there's nothing in his performances today to suggest he doesn't, he's going to rise to the occasion. Whether that's enough to get him through, it remains to be seen. But I think we can all agree he's done everybody proud with those 2 sensational performances so far. And if he can get a bronze medal, that's the least he deserves, and all bets are off after that.
Kelly Harrington then this morning, cold, calculated, ruthless, I think is how I would describe that performance. Just so no nonsense, and I guess no surprises on your end whatsoever that this performance was ready to happen.
No, we did a good preview with Amy Broadhurst earlier in the week, and Amy beat this Italian opponent in European Under 22's tournament a couple of years ago. So we kind of knew what we were getting, and Kelly would have known it too. And you could kind of see it in her performance. She obviously won the first round quite clearly and was switching stances, as not unusual for Kelly Harrington, but she was switching from orthodox to southpaw quite regularly, throwing punches from slightly unconventional angles as if she's trying a few things out, I would have thought, which is it's a little bit of a dangerous game to play, but not that she was underestimating her opponent, but if she's ever going to get some practice in, she made the point that she's been in Japan since June 30th, and it's like it's a full month on, and she obviously carried the flag out last Friday and is the last Irish boxer to get into the ring. So I think she was just hoping to really maximize this outing, because it's going to get a little bit tougher towards semi-final time. Her next fight is, it looks pretty winnable. And again, I don't want to be putting the knockers on it necessarily, but you would 100% back Kelly Harrington to make at least a semi-final. And then it gets really, really enticing when you look at some of the cast of characters in that lightweight draw.
It does seem that Kelly Harrington is amazing when she's got a lead. That, in fairness, she's one of the best fighters in her division, so that will probably be her default position anyway. But how much would you back her if she were to lose a first round, for example?
Yeah, it's just, I think the stats, I don't know, has it been updated for this game, but somewhere in the mid 80% is where if you win the first round in amateur boxing, that's how whoever wins the first round basically wins the fight. So it is difficult for anybody to overcome, especially in the 10-9 scoring system. In Olympics gone by, on the old point for each punch scored, you could easily make up the deficit in one round, but it's a bit trickier now. You need to sort of establish a standing eight count on your opponent or literally knock them down to get a 10-8, and that could cause a seismic swing. But I think Kelly, the beauty of Kelly is she can have it any way that you want it. Like in the qualifying tournament for these games, she boxed a professional fighter, Amadouche, who is now out of these games. She was beaten by Mira Pakkinen. More of her and none, I'm sure we're going to see in Mira at some point in this tournament. But so she beat her in quite a physical fight, and you know, it was she had to fight almost a pro style, but outboxed Amadouche in the end. Then she had to beat the golden girl, Caroline Dubois, who the Olympics might be coming ever so slightly early for her, but you certainly wouldn't rule her out of a final contention. But she outboxed her, and basically, like, it was just an experience. Like, she was able to establish experience over Caroline Dubois, tricks of the trade, a proper, like, old-school amateur boxing match, and she beat her as well. So that's the beauty of Kelly Harrington. No matter what what's put in front of her here, she will be able to deal with it. And that's why I think most people in Irish boxing and beyond have good confidence in her not to falter in a fight that she should be winning.
Dubois wrote a good piece in The Guardian during the week, Ronan, a smashing piece, and spoke in great detail about Harrington and what absolutely wanting another crack at her. As you say, they met obviously in the European qualifiers in June, and there's a big age difference between them, a big sort of experience difference in them as well. Is that the way we're headed with this? How does the draw work out? And just talk to us briefly as well about, is the Moroccan in the next round?
So is Algeria in the next round? Khalif, yeah, has done decent things at African level, but nothing major on the international scene. So barring any banana skins, you would hope Kelly would navigate that one okay. And then you're in semi-finals, so you're talking Caroline Dubois there, or the Thai opponent, who Kelly beat in her world championship victory in 2018. So whatever way you look at it, that's going to be a difficult semi-final. And like, Olympic medals are hard earned, so she's going to have to, if she wants to be competing for gold, that's the kind of hurdle you have to overcome. So I think we're all looking forward to that one. It's really getting into the business end now. Like, Sunday is going to be thrilling for Irish boxing fans and Irish sports fans. Those two fights, Curt Walker's and Aidan Walsh's, are virtually back-to-back, I think 3:30 a.m. followed by 4 a.m. So, and a bank holiday weekend, lads. So I think everybody can justify getting up to watch that one, and then Kelly into Tuesday. So quite a triumvirate of fights. And yeah, I think they all have daunting opponents. As I mentioned, Kelly's probably looking more towards the semi-final for her stiff test, but the other two lads are right up against it on Sunday.
Ronan, enjoy every little bit of it. We'll chat to you again on Monday morning, I hope.
All right, cheers, lads.
Cheers, Ronan. So Sunday morning, or late Saturday night, depending on what way you want to look at it, is going to be a momentous morning for Irish boxing, and brilliant opportunities for everybody involved in that. Right, at 8:26 on this Friday morning, it is time for our GAA Quick Picks.
Some of these critics, these pundits,
I absolutely adore them, lads. I have unbelievable time for them, but they're a great bunch, but it's not acceptable.
They like to play the hard man when they're on it. It's not very pleasant when you're trying to manage a team. All you're looking for is a bit of civility and a bit of decency, but they just dismiss you like you know, you have nothing to do with the bloody occasion.
Yeah, time for our GAA Quick Picks. This is what we do every week as we look to preview the weekend's action in very accurate style. But there's only one man really who's involved in this who's been accurately predicting what's going to happen over the next little while. That man is Adrian Barry. And Adrian Barry, as we can see on our leaderboard, is well ahead of us. And he has been kicking all of our asses, really, in terms of his predictions throughout the last couple of weeks. So let's have a look at the predictions table. There I am in last place on 34 points. Tommy, you're in third place on 35 points. Will, you're in second place on 36 points. And Adrian Barry keeping your 3-point cushion. But the lead has narrowed a little bit between you and Will O'Callaghan, that is, because Will, you were the only person who correctly predicted that the Rebels were going to do the business last week in the hurling, that is.
Yeah, well, look, it's tight at the top, lads. 3 points is no lead at all when we've got bonus points on offer this weekend for the margin of victory. And I think, what, we've got about 8 fixtures left for the season now. I think there's plenty of time for all of us to catch up with Adrian Barry between now and the end. And this weekend might well be a moving weekend for us.
I think so. Adrian, are you getting nervous?
No, I consider that my wobbly week on, to be honest with you. Right. And if I've come out of it with a 3-point lead, I'll take it.
Yeah, Tommy Rooney, I think congratulations is in order to you. The only person who put a double figure Kerry scoreline on there went over Cork, and in fairness, you didn't even get to halfway to the actual eventual scoreline, but still, you were the only person who went double figure. So fair play to you. I will give you that credit, considering I didn't have the balls to go there myself.
You were unlucky, but I can't imagine you make the same mistake this week.
You're going to make what mistake again this week?
I said you can't make the same mistake this week.
Well, Kerry aren't playing this week, thankfully.
Well, with the Dubs back, you know, there's no way you could possibly play conservative one more time.
Well, we shall see. Let's get into the hurling picks, I think, first up this week, to have a look at what people are going for. So 2 quarterfinals up for decision this weekend. They're both on tomorrow. Waterford against Tip and Dublin against Cork. So Waterford against Tip, first of all, we can see the predictions here on screen. Adrian going for Tip by 6. I'm going for a Tip by 2. Tommy's going for a Tip by 5. And Will is going for a Tip by 3. Tommy, talk us through your decision there.
I think we've all written off Waterford plenty of times so far this year. I think we all confidently tipped Galway last week, isn't that right?
Yes.
There was no one making any case whatsoever for Waterford. And halfway through that game last week, you were probably thinking, right, Waterford are here. But then the manner in which Galway came back in that game and they nearly caught them, I know there was red cards, but I just think Tip are going to have too much of them. We were talking about form lines earlier in the year, and we were trying to figure out whether Clare or Wexford were in better form coming into that game. And we argued successfully that Clare were in better form. Clare were caught by Cork last week. Again, kudos to Will, he called that one. I just think that Tip are going to have too much for Waterford. I think they're just going to have too much up front. And like, I haven't called, I'm not, this isn't the ballsiest call of the week. Like, I'm only saying 5 points. It's not that big. I think I'm pretty close to the handicap. But yeah, I reckon it'll be Tip by 5. A couple of goals will be the difference.
Will, are you concerned at all about the psychological damage that comeback win by Limerick will have done to Tipperary?
A little bit. I mean, that game finishes after 40 minutes in Portiquive, and we start saying the Tipperary are back to their form of 2019 and they could potentially win the All-Ireland Championship this year. And then we saw Limerick put in a performance for the ages. How much of that is down to Tipperary wilting within the fixture, and how much of it is down to just the sheer brilliance of Limerick? We'll probably find out a bit more about that by the end of the game tomorrow evening. Like, I'm a little bit more wobbly about this fixture than Tommy is, in terms of, okay, Waterford have put in 1 or 2 indifferent performances. We spoke about the Laois game going into last week and whether that was going to be the kick up the backside that the Dacia needed going into that fixture against Galway. It's so difficult to read the form in some of these hurling games, though, lads, where we've had a team streak ahead and then in the second half we've had a thrilling comeback to turn it into a contest in the final stages. But Waterford have to be somewhat tired after their exertions over the last month. It's been fairly week on week and difficult fixtures that they've played. I wonder, is that going to catch up with them, with a Tipperary team who've had a couple of weeks to just brush off the Limerick defeat and get things back ready for this game? Again, I think Sheedy sticks with the tried and tested and the players that he played in that Munster final. And I think Tipperary will win, but I don't think it's going to be like 5-6 points. I think this is going to be a 1-score game to come to finish. I think 3 points is my prediction for this. So I think Tipperary just about, and maybe the freshness might actually be the only difference between the sides at the end.
Yeah, I'm the only one who's gone narrower than you in terms of that Tipperary win, Will. And I think if tiredness is going to become an issue, I think it'll only be down the closing stretches, and I fully expect this to be a cracker going into those closing stretches. Like, Galway maybe weren't at the races last week, but I still think a 16-point lead against any fellow Tier 1 team is worth your weight in gold, really, in terms of judging somebody's form. of course, they didn't manage to sustain it for the whole thing. And I guess if you're going to use that logic, then you could also use that logic in terms of supporting Tipperary after what they did to Limerick in the first half. But I think maybe there was just a lot in that Waterford performance last week that was angry, and it was a bit of a response to Leash the previous week. And I don't know, like here in the quick picks, none of us really saw them running out big winners. Most of us saw them getting beaten, and I think we were all astonished to see that early lead. So I think that they've defied expectations already, and I think they will run Tipperary very, very close. Like, I guess the argument I'm making there should probably lead to me tipping Waterford, but I actually think in the end that
bottom of the table. Yeah, would you not take a chance?
I've taken a slight chance in the football. Also, I'm playing honourably here. I'm putting in my predictions before I even look at your predictions, so I'm just staying true to myself.
All right, okay. So, we've only your word for that one.
Well, that's exactly true.
Well, you can take over the accumulation of tips next week, Adrian Barry. You are going for the biggest tip win of the four of us.
I subscribe to your theory about it maybe getting the lead getting a bit stretched down the closing stages. I think Waterford have a tough enough year, and a big enough year in a lot of ways. And I am putting a lot of store in the first half of the Limerick game, and I am slightly cautious about maybe reading too much into that. But I think that Tipperary will believe that they're very close to Limerick in a way that I'm not sure Waterford really are. I think that that game will be fairly major fuel in the fire for Tipperary. I think they could take all the positives they want out of it. And Conrad Leeson is out, I think, as well. So I think it'll be Tipperary. Look, it will kind of touch on earlier on with hurling. There might not be very much between the teams at times, but you can still end up with 6 or 7 or 8 points between them. And I think that will be what will happen this weekend.
Out of the four of us, Will, you have gone for the smallest margin of victory for Cork. Are you nervous?
Not so much nervous, but Cork have been consistent in their inconsistency over the last few years, and they sparkled at times last weekend against Clare in like a not particularly great game by comparison to the first one. It was scrappy at stages, but when Cork got their forwards on the move, like, they're so dangerous and they run the ball incredibly well. But I continue to have concerns about their defence, and sometimes that inconsistency just creeping into stages of their performance. And this Cork team are more than capable of putting it up to any team left in the championship on a one-off battle. But then again, they're also perfectly capable to get the easiest draw on Monday, which is Dublin, and then end up messing that draw up and losing. Now, they did win the last time the teams met in the championship, and that's when Dublin were going in with a head of steam, and many people thought maybe Dublin could put it up to Cork. I think Cork still win, but I don't see this being a huge margin of victory by the end. I can see Dublin sticking in with it. Dublin have actually had a pretty good year when you consider it, lads, especially with the Leinster final, to go in and have four players ripped away from your panel due to COVID-19 on the day of the game, and still to put it up to Kilkenny, you know, the team who've been within the top three in the country for the last three seasons. This Dublin team aren't an easy nut to crack, and like, they kept Galway down to a very low scoreline in the Leinster semi-final too. So I think Cork win, but I think Dublin can really put it up to them for large stages of that game tomorrow afternoon.
All right, those are the hurling predictions. Let's have a look at the football predictions. Across the weekend, we've got two more provincial finals. We've got Monaghan against Tyrone in Ulster and Dublin against Kildare in Leinster. This is where I tried to play it a little bit tactically on Monaghan against Tyrone. I'm not going to lie, all the talk in Kerry at the moment is of a Kerry-Tyrone All-Ireland semi-final. And as the week has gone on, the more I'm like, this is a little bit presumptuous. This is, in fact, extremely presumptuous given the few weeks that Monaghan have had. They are riding this awful wave of emotion that led to obviously an incredible performance in that second half against Armagh just a couple of weeks ago, the very day after the tragedy that they had in Monaghan GAA. That is something that seems to not be holding them back. It seems to be almost inspiring them in a really awful way, if you want to put it like that, over the last couple of weeks. And I think there is another massive kick for Monaghan coming this weekend. I think that if Tyrone are going to win this Ulster final, they're going to do it with a very slight scoreline, first of all. And I know, Will and Tommy, you've both gone for Tyrone by 2 points, and you don't see this being a big win for them either, and I don't think many people will. And I'm going to go one step further, and I actually think Monaghan might turn them over this weekend. Now, if I'd known that Adrian was going to go Monaghan as well, I might have actually just stuck to what the head was actually saying, and saying that Tyrone might actually edge this one at the end. And I accept that I'm not layering you on with loads of footballing evidence here to suggest that Monaghan are a better team than Tyrone, but emotion is an incredible thing when you get into the real deep end of a championship, and I think Monaghan have that in spades, and I would not be surprised to see them going through to Croke Park, well, going through from Croke Park to Croke Park this weekend, so to speak.
Yeah, like it's going to be close to us. This one's going down to the wire, and I think our picks, I think each of us picked 2 points. I know you, yourself and Adrian on Monaghan, we're on Tyrone. I think if it goes down to a shootout, like I know Darren McCurry is in sensational form, but if it becomes a shootout towards the end, I would be getting nervous because Jack McCarron and Conor McManus are two footballers, and we've seen it time and time again this year. They're clutch footballers, and if Monaghan get it down to the wire, I believe that Monaghan had the experience on the bench. I don't know whether Banty will make a couple of changes before the start of the game. He's got quite an attacking setup up front. Defensively, they're quite suspect. So maybe Banty will bring in a couple of older players, older Monaghan heads into that half forward line and play a bit more defensively. Like, I would be nervous about this one going down the stretch if it's a 1-2 point game, because we saw what Monaghan did to Armagh. Armagh should have won that match, even though Monaghan ran in front. They let that lead slip. Armagh brought it back. They were a point up with a few minutes to go. They should have won that game. And Monaghan showed their experience to get that score. It's always really close between these two. I've gone for Tyrone because I was so impressed watching that Donegal game back a few times, even by their bench. The Tiernan McCann, Colin McShane, Mark Bradley, Conor McKenna, Paul Donaghy didn't even get off the bench. And we know how impressive he was in his championship debut. So I'm just back in Tyrone, but just about this week.
Adrian, why are you siding with Monaghan?
Well, I think on Tommy's point there about the Donegal game, like, we don't know actually whether Donegal was anything much to crow about. Like, we might look back after this game and go, well, they, you know, Donegal were not up to much. I think that I think Tyrone are coming, and they obviously are. And I just think that Ulster is so gnarly, they need a bit of pain first, and they haven't probably had. Maybe they'll get it at the weekend and they'll come through it, I don't know. But it doesn't, I think in Ulster you need a bit of pain. I think Monaghan obviously have loads of that in the bottle from last year that they'll probably open up again. I think the Armagh win for me was so impressive as well, that like the disappearing out of the game for so long, which you can say is a really worrying sign, and we won't know really out of that until after this weekend. But I think that all the momentum was gone for them, and they still somehow, Tommy mentioned the two lads earlier on, Conor McManus particularly, but they somehow managed to balls it out. And I saw Pascal McConnell during the week saying that if you keep Monaghan goals out, you beat them. You're discounting the 21 scores, whatever it was they got against Armagh, if you count them only as points, I still think that that's Monaghan on the right side of a win. And interestingly, the only game that they didn't score a goal against this year, I think, was Tyrone, funny enough, in the league. But I think there'll be enough in the tank, and I think they'll there's enough pain there, and I think they'll get it done.
Yeah, I agree. Will?
Yeah, I hummed and hawed about this one, lads. Very difficult to call. I'm probably on a similar line to Tommy's thinking on this, in that I actually was very impressed with how Tyrone got the job done against Donegal last time out, albeit Donegal playing with 14 men for so much of the game. But when Tyrone needed a kick in that fixture, they had an extra gear and they were able to inject a little bit of pace and extra attacking intent from the bench, which I think they're probably going to need at Croke Park on tomorrow afternoon too. Like, I would fancy Monaghan much more if this final was taking place in the province of Ulster as opposed to it being in Croke Park. I just think Tyrone are going to go up there, they're going to arm wrestle this one out, and they're going to go and give Kerry hopefully a bit of a rattle in the semi-finals.
Yeah, I think I think both semi-finals actually this year are going to be brilliant games. And if you have a look at the football predictions again, sorry, I'll just run through these. We don't necessarily need to do a whole pile of previews. We're all picking a healthy Dublin win. I think I've actually gone for the smallest Dublin win at 12 points. So I'll actually be hoping for Dublin to narrowly scrape by this one. I thought I was going big with 12, but not really. Adrian and Tommy both going for 13 and Will going for 15. So I think you know exactly what we're going to say with regards to that. Kildare, not the opposition that Meath were even, and
the spread is 10 points on,
the spread is 10 points, right,
like,
okay.
And then you take the Kevin Feely injury into account as well, lads, on this one. Like, he goes down, hurts his knee against Westmeath. As Adrian would be aware, the amount of chances that Kildare coughed up against Westmeath too, if they're that porous at the back against Dublin, yeah, I think Dublin win this at a canter.
And there's a Dublin backlash coming at some point, lads, as well. And I was listening to Eamon Fitzmaurice on the Examiner podcast earlier this week, and he kind of made a connection between this Dublin team and Kerry in 09, where Kerry were winning, but only just. Now, Dublin aren't just winning. And then when they got to Croke Park, they hammered the life out of Dublin in that quarterfinal. And I think that there is a performance like that coming in this Dublin team. Now, Kildare aren't, that won't have the same, it won't be as emphatic as beating Dublin in 09 was, but I think Kildare could be a big performance, and then Mayo, unfortunately, could be chum in the water for Dublin in the semi-finals, even though I think that we could be in store for a good last four.
Owen Doyle is a massive loss as well, lads. He did his hamstring, I think, in that game, so he looks like he's definitely going to be out. Daniel Flynn had a couple of moments of magic against Westmeath, but I'd say he touched the ball it was in the single digits the amount of times he touched the ball. He wasn't fully right. Luke Flynn is back for him, which is a big return, but like, I think you're right on. I think Dublin are angry.
Okay, that is this week's Quick Picks.
Absolutely adore them lads. I have unbelievable time for them, but they're a great bunch, but it's not acceptable.
Just to let you know that the OTB Sports Olympic show is live from 5 o'clock across the OTB Sports app and the Off The Ball channels throughout the Olympics, as we bring you the biggest stories of the day and also take a look ahead to what's coming up. It'll all be brought to you in association with Indeed, who are proud to support Team Ireland at the Tokyo 2020 Games. Indeed believes the world works better when people are given every opportunity to unleash their true talents. Hashtag talent unleashed. Will O'Callaghan, you've got the latest on what's going on in Tokyo.
Yeah, we've got medal number three, Belfast boxer Aidan Walsh securing at least bronze this morning after he went through to the semi-finals of the welterweight division. He got a 4-1 split decision victory against Melvin Clare of Mauritius in the early hours of this morning. He'll face off against Britain's Pat McCormack in Sunday's semi-final. I liked on the TV, he was asked about his chances against McCormack and he said, look lads, Pat McCormack has to face Aidan Walsh this weekend. Mm-hmm. So he's very confident of his chances of upgrading that to at least silver by getting through to the final. Kelly Harrington eventually having to wait a long time to get into the ring because of the draw giving her a bye into the round of 16. She's up and running with a victory, very comprehensive against Rebecca Nicoli of Italy this morning. No real trouble for the former world champion, and the top seed is now into the quarterfinals this weekend. If she wins that bout, she will also secure a medal. Waterford's Thomas Barr, I know you're chatting to Carl Denny about this earlier in the show, into the semi-finals of the 400 metres hurdles. The 29-year-old who was fourth in the event at the Rio Games was second in his heat, but he faces a very difficult semi-final on Sunday afternoon Irish time. Three Irish athletes didn't get out of their heats in the 800 metres. Nadia Power, Louise Shanahan and Shifra Clerick-Butner failed to advance in their semi-finals. We do later this morning, a little bit after 11 o'clock, have our mixed relay team who are going to be in action in the 4x400s. That's Sophie Becker, Phil Healy, Killian Green and Christopher O'Donnell. Tom Barr was originally on that team but couldn't take part because he was in his individual race this morning. Great news from the golf in terms of Shane Lowry and Rory McIlroy. They've hugely boosted their medal chances today. Tied for fourth place as things stand. Still a handful of players who are out on course because of the delay due to strong, heavy rain, I should say, and thunder earlier. But Lowry and McIlroy both 7 under par at the midway point and they're currently 3 shots off the lead. McIlroy carded a 5 under round of 66, disappointed to have a bogey on the last. Lowry went around one better in 65. That's a 6 under round for the former Open champion there. The Irish women's hockey team face a real uphill task to qualify for the quarterfinals. They will need a win against reigning Olympic champions Great Britain tomorrow if they're to get out of Pool A, and they'll have to wait and see what happens between India and South Africa too. Sean Dancer's team suffered a 1-0 loss to India, conceding in the last quarter, but they were under pressure throughout the game. Annalise Murphy won't be picking up back-to-back medals. Her chances of winning a medal in the laser radial sailing are over. The 2016 silver medalist was in 40th place, which is so disappointing after two races yesterday where she was first and second. She ended up in 18th place overall with just the top 10 boats qualifying for the medal race. Three more races to come tomorrow for Robert Dixon and Sean Waddalove. They're in 14th place overall in the 49er event. Two top 10 finishes for them today. And in the football, lads, Bohemians manager Keith Long says he's loving every moment of their European adventure. They'll face Pauk in the third round of qualifying for the UEFA Conference League after another win at the Aviva last night. Georgie Kelly found the net twice as Bowes beat Dudelange of Luxembourg 3-0 to secure a 4-0 aggregate victory. Next up for Dundalk is a meeting with Vitesse Arnhem after the Lily White struck late to win in Estonia. Will Patching scored in the 92nd minute to give Vinnie Perth's side a 4-3 aggregate win against Lavadia Tallinn. Shamrock Rovers will also be in the third round of qualifying for the Conference League. They're now one game away from potentially playing against some of the big European sides in round four and two rounds away from qualifying from the group stage of the competition. Shamrock Rovers in action tonight, top of the table clash in the Air Tricity League. They go up against St. Pat's at Tallaght Stadium.
Will O'Callaghan, great stuff. We'll chat to you again soon. It is 8:45 on this Friday morning. You're with us here on OTBAM. We'll be chatting to Alan Quinlan ahead of the second lines test in just a moment. But before that, Tommy Walsh joined Nathan on last night's show to pay tribute to Joe Canning after his retirement. It's a brilliant 20-minute chat, by the way, well worth seeking out on the OTB Sports app. Here's what Tommy said made Joe so great.
Skill. This evening, he was very fast. I always found Niall Gilligan was the same from Clare, a big guy. You would never say he was fast. He was like a rocket. I thought Joe was very, very powerful fast. But the one thing that I'll come back to with Joe is skill. Going back to when he was like, if he was growing up now, he would have missed one or two county finals and maybe a club All-Ireland because of the age. You can't play now with your senior team until you're 18 years of age in that year. He won a county final or two before he reached 18. He won a club All-Ireland. And you don't, not everybody gets to do that. It doesn't matter what size you are. So, like, you only have to go back to his debut season, 2008, when he was marking the rock. So you'd say, was it about size with Joe? Is that why he was able to get them scores? He was on Dermot Sullivan, you know. I had him in one of, I think I had him number one in the hardest players that played the game. And he scored, was it 2-12 that day? 2008, Cork were in their pomp as well at the time, that great Cork team of the mid-noughties. So what it'll always go back to me with Joe is skill. Like sideline cuts, scored 27 of them. That's only a small thing. He scored, was it 4 sideline cuts in last year's All-Ireland semi-final. He scored 116 in a Fitzgibbon Cup final that they lost. They'd won it the previous year with LIT, but the following year they got to another Fitzgibbon Cup final. They lost. He scored 116. I think he scored another 4 sideline cuts. Like, look at the all-time leading sideline cuts in Championship hurling. He is 27. The next nearest to him that's playing still today is Austin Gleeson on 6. Like, I was practicing since lockdown came in. I've been practicing sideline cuts and I still can't get 20 or 30 yards over the bar. So, like, some lads have just this insane talent and then they back it up with years and years and years of hard work. And Joe did that. And
yeah, brilliant stuff there from Tommy Welsh last night. You can catch the full piece back on our YouTube channel or on the OTB Sports app as well. We are turning our attention to rugby in just a moment. We've got Alan Quinlan with us this morning. Alan, how are you getting on?
I'm very good on yourself.
All good. I thought come Friday morning we wouldn't have any more Razzie Erasmus stuff to talk about, but lo and behold, an hour-long video on Vimeo yesterday has sparked more headlines. This is getting out of hand now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. I couldn't believe it when I saw it yesterday. The organised, detailed presentation from Razzie was incredible, I think. And it's making all the headlines now. Everybody has an opinion on it. The vast majority of people, I suppose all the South African people online are sticking up for Razzie, saying he's right. And then people around Britain, Ireland are saying it's terrible and it shouldn't have happened. It was just phenomenal, really, to see the detail and the explanations. And this is not something we've ever seen before.
That's it. It's truly unprecedented. And like, whether or not it's right or wrong or any of that sort of argument, like, why has he gone to such lengths, do you think? Because he could make the points he was trying to make in press conferences in a more concise manner, a la Warren Gatland, for example, or a lot of rugby coaches. We've seen this all the time, Alan. So why has he taken this to a level we've never seen before, do you think?
Frustration and mind games, I think. I think he's obviously frustrated with some of the big calls. Razzie's a very passionate guy, and you can see, if you watch Chasing the Sun, you can see his reaction in the press box, and he's so engrossed in what's happening. He's kind of playing every ball. He's involved in every tackle, every ruck. He's moving around the whole time. I think he's frustrated with some of the decisions, and I think he has a right to be frustrated with some of the decisions, first and foremost. And every single coach in the professional game tries to get feedback after games. If they lose a match and they're frustrated with decisions that went against them, there's a process that you, at all levels in the professional game, that you'll try and get feedback, and you'll send in video clips and you'll question some of the decisions. The referees then have their own reviews with the referee managers, and they go through that. They do it here in Ireland, and you know, for Pro 14 games or European games, Irish referees involved have that process with Johnny Lacey. It happens then, obviously, at the top level. Joel Juge is head of world referees. He'd review the referee's performances with the referee, and Nick Berry's would have been reviewed last weekend. I think the frustration was, and it was a bit unfair for Razzie to expect on Sunday to get all these questions answered and get these replies. That's why he said he went public with it, because he couldn't wait until Tuesday. It was too long, and I find it a bit far-fetched that he was basing his selections on somebody's interpretations that he was looking for. said he had a chat with the referee, which again is common practice at the top international level, where you get feedback from the referees pre-match and you things they're kind of don't want to see, things that are good in your team. And that's very, very common for both Warren Gatland and Rassie Erasmus to have met Nick Berry last week. But the frustration then for Rassie is some of the things that he said he would be watching and highlighting. He seemed to think that he didn't do that for South Africa. But Owen, you could pull apart every match at that level and in the professional game and find side entries, players going off their feet, 50-50 calls and scrums that could have gone the other way. You could have an argument to say that a guy's elbow was on the ground first and the penalty should have gone your way. And it's very, very common that coaches will air their frustrations in private in a manner that they'll present and they'll question such and such a thing on the 17th minute, on the 24th minute, on the 60th minute. And it'll be that detailed and it'll be sent through the channel to the head of the referees, whoever that is at the time. And they will reply with answers to say, well, look, you were right with this one, you were wrong with that one. And they'll try and explain it out to keep a little bit of continuity around it. Because rugby is very difficult to referee, again, because we all have a different interpretation. Some decisions are very, very clear cut, but I think the ones at scrum time and at the breakdown are very difficult at times. Some guys are poaching a ball. Referee says he's on his elbow, he's not supporting his weight. You see a replay, and I know this from commentary, and I say, well, that's not the case here. I think it should be the other way. So I have lots of those decisions. So I think it's just born out of pure frustration and trying to put pressure back on the officials. So some international coaches will love this. They will be delighted that this has come out because they feel that it's a controlled environment, that there is no accountability from the referees. The danger here is if you kind of get into that space where you have referees being interviewed after games and stuff like that, that you just turn people off because it's very difficult. So part of me thinks I understand his frustration. Another part of me thinks he shouldn't have done it because he should have just been patient and waited. But he could have went through journalists during the week and aired his frustrations. But going public with this video, probably a step too far. But there's another part to me that if I was a player, I've come off the field so many times and just had that frustration. And we do video reviews then and we see all these decisions that went against us and things that weren't picked up. And I just thought Nick Berry, I had that feeling after the game the other day because that some of these decisions kind of really swayed towards the against the South Africans in the second half. But if you scrutinized it and went through every line situation where they had the ball and things that the South Africans did, you could probably find loads of clips that the lines could argue to say that they should have got more penalties or they should have got some of the decisions. So great entertainment, but in dangerous territory, really, I would say.
It is great entertainment and it's been brilliant for all of us watching on. I think it definitely gives an extra edge to the games and all that. But like the theory, Quinny, that it sounds like you subscribe to, which is this is just another version of the Warren Gatland stuff from the previous week about the TMO. It's unprecedented, like what he's done to sit down and do this hour-long video, like you say, picking apart decisions that are 50-50 calls that some weeks will go one way and another week will go another.
Some are not 50-50, some are about 80-20.
Yeah, sorry, clear.
Clear argument. Some of them are yeah, I know you get that.
Your point is 100%. Some of those things that he was talking about, Curry particularly coming into the side, tackling the player's leg, absolutely no question about it. But they're the sort of decisions that happen in a game, like you say, and sometimes they go your way and sometimes they don't. But the unprecedented nature of the video, right, and like this hour-long sort of sit-down, Where is he coming from with this stuff? And like, is it in some ways, Quinny, looking at it, it feels like the unraveling of a man in front of our eyes. It's either that or it's like this guy is just an absolute genius.
It's one or the other. Yeah. But look, he obviously feels so strongly about this that there were certain things that Nick Berry said to him on Friday and that he just didn't apply that. And it's absolute frustration, I think. And he seems to just say, look, I don't care about the consequences here. This is, if you're being told one thing by a referee, and he doesn't apply that situation in the match, well, and then you can't get a response. Now, in Nick Berry's defense, he's building up to a test match all week. The eyes of the world are on this game. He does his match, has his meal, has a few beers or whatever if he wants. He's entitled to kind of have a bit of a downtime on Sunday. I saw some nasty comments online about a referee having a nap at 5 o'clock on Sunday. He may not have slept at all Saturday night. I've often been in a situation where I played a game on Saturday evening. It's very difficult to sleep. You wake up early.
But Erasmus shouldn't be putting that stuff out, Quinny. That's why I talk about
it. Probably that stuff went a little bit personal there.
He kind of said it, didn't he, in a way that was like, oh, that's fair enough, but that's not what he meant. There was aspects to it that definitely pointed to that Erasmus has lost control a little bit here.
As you say, at the start, either lost control or it's genius. Look, I know World Rugby are not going to be happy about it. It's not the done thing. But there's another part of me, Adrian, that says, and you know, Johnny Lacey's one of my best mates and he's a referee and I always respect his opinion on what should or shouldn't happen around these things and protocols. You know, I've great time for Joe. He's head of World Rugby now and but Joe, if he was honest and openly admitted, he probably was close to being vocal on some of this stuff or wanted us some of the times. Because I remember chatting to him at times and watching Ireland games and just being incredibly frustrated myself if I was involved in commentating the game with some of the decisions. So there's a danger that's, you know, referees are telling you one thing and doing the other. And that's where it's come from with him. So look, I don't think it's the end of the world. I think maybe it'll create a debate around these channels and maybe a bit more accountability. But the negative side of that then, Adrian, is will it turn people off and say, Jesus, I don't want to get involved in this. I often have it myself with my own commentaries. If you're kind of in the lap of the gods, really, at people's mercy of criticizing you, and you're being in a situation where you're doing commentating a match, and you go, sometimes I've kind of scratched my head afterwards and said, why do I bother? I do it because I love it, and he coaches because he loves it, and referees do it because they love it. But if you're going to be criticized openly, and the world is different now with social media, and everybody has an opinion, and you create a hate and a nastiness which it does spill over to the referees. You know, Nick Berry will probably have to carry this for a while. There's people who make comments to him in public if they meet him. You know, that's the dangerous place we're in. So one part of it is great that you kind of bring this thing out in the open. And, you know, these guys are professional referees. They're getting paid as well. So that's the difference here. He's getting paid. And there has to be some bit of accountability. Players have to be accountable all the time. And there's a protection there for referees, which I'm not saying open the thing completely and say make them accountable publicly and have to do interviews and all that kind of stuff. But big decisions cost people jobs, cost people a lot. And it's very hard. I don't have the right answers. And I think maybe Joel Drew should have intervened here and got back quicker to Rassi. Maybe Rassi should have sent this stuff straight to Joel Drew, who's the head of the referees. And if he wanted to process on Sunday, requested that Joel Drew come back to him. He says he made a phone call Sunday night, got a message minder. And I think it's against protocol for him to be going contacting Nick Berry anyway. He should have went straight to Joel Drew on the Sunday and sent all these clips. And then if he didn't get adequate responses in time, well, he could have went public about Joel Hughes not getting back to him and maybe said, look, that he was going to go public. Could have been handled a bit better. But look, I think there's a lot of legitimate arguments in the videos he played, but it probably should have been held back, to be honest. He may regret it and it may work out for him.
Yeah, he's been tweeting again this morning. Somebody, Jaco Johan, tweeted him again.
You're joking.
John O'Sullivan article from May of last year in the Irish Times about the tackle that ended Brian O'Driscoll's tour in 2005. It was a sporting controversies article. And noted, thanks JJ, is his reply. Brian Moore made a point on Twitter yesterday, Quinny, just it's my last point about it, because I'm conscious that like there's a game to talk about and maybe this is what he wants, but Brian Moore made the point that about the video that nothing in there explained why South Africa lost. Like, you know, so that maybe that's the genius side of it, that like, you know, here we
but
are.
I disagree with that. Talking like, about... I disagree with that, because there's loads in there explained why South Africa lost.
Sorry, just to do him service. Sorry, Quinny, to go to crash it. Just to do him service. What he talked about was stuff like the dominant first half, that South Africa didn't score a try. The front row gamble didn't work. Lost the collision in the aerial battle. So he was very much more specific than that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, there were certain things that I thought their performance in the second half, when they had the ball and when they had control, was really poor. They played two phases, tried to kick the ball, inaccurate kicks as well, lost those aerial battles, as you said. Still could have won the game if the Willy LaRue try was given, if the Damien Diolinde one wasn't a knock-on from Colby. So there were small margins, but neither side created anything. And that was the frustration for me. It was just an unbelievably disappointing game to commentate on and be involved in and to watch. But I wasn't surprised. And don't be surprised on Saturday if you see more of the same arm wrestle, confrontational, players smashing each other, and loads and loads and loads and loads of kicks. And I would have just loved if South Africa had been a bit shrewder and tried to play a little bit more. But in their defence, they didn't have it in their legs. They looked very, very tired. And it's only half a second or half a metre off in some of those kick chases that maybe cost them at the weekend. And the line's been better. So I think we've missed a point here as well. And in all this chat, the lines were really, really good in that second half. And Warren Gatland deserves a lot of credit for getting his team to come out and react. I thought it was South Africa were so comfortable in that first half. But definitely the fact that South Africa haven't played in a long time. They had all these COVID cases and they looked really, really undercooked from a match fitness point of view and tired so much. Hence, they've gone with the 6-2 split this week and are trying to go back to that bomb squad narrative of the forwards coming on, making a huge impact. They didn't have that impact last week. So it'll be really interesting what happens. But they did make mistakes. And he acknowledged that at the start of the week. He said it was strange. Razzie said it was, he tweeted that there was no excuse from us, better side won. But I know, again, as a player, being in a room and you're analysing matches and you're looking back at videos, stuff jumps out at you. You go, wow, 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 at times. And I've had that experience. And that's probably what happened with him, particularly around... I would imagine if Nick Berry was very adamant about certain things and he didn't do it, that's what drove Razzie to do this. And it could backfire on him or it could work. They might get some of those decisions on Saturday. But I have a feeling that Ben O'Keefe won't be swayed, Matthew Reynal and Nick Berry. And Marius Jonker, who he says is a very good friend of his, has he made his job even more harder now for the weekend? I don't know. It's crazy stuff.
Who's going to win tomorrow, Alan?
Well, I said South Africa last week, and I think if they manage the game better in the second half, even with that kind of energetic kind of surge from the lines in the second half, they could have still got the job done. I just have a feeling South Africa will level the series. I think obviously there's way more pressure on them all now because, you know, small margins and small mistakes here, and if things start to go against them, will that get into their heads? But I just think you're going to see a real aggressive surge tomorrow. And, you know, historically, you know, in 2017, New Zealand's kind of out-muscled the lines in that first test. And then there was a great response. So we're going to get an inevitable kind of surge of passion, fire from the Springboks. And I just think it might get them there. But they have to be a little bit more shrewder in what they're playing. If they just keep kicking and kicking and kicking, I'd like to see them a little bit more braver. And I think they'll have, obviously, that 80 minutes under their belt might give them that just little bit of match fitness that's needed. So I think they might just get across the line and level the series.
All right, Alan, enjoy the game. We'll chat to you again on Monday.
Cheers. Thanks, lads.
Cheers. Alan Quinlan there with us every Monday and Friday on OTB AM. Let's tell you what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. From 1 o'clock, we've got OTB Gold with Catherine Switzer. From 3 o'clock, it is Friday Night Racing. And then 4 o'clock is the Olympic show. 6 o'clock then will be OTB Gold with Ronnie Delaney. And then from 7 p.m, Off the Ball is live on air and on the OTB Sports app. We've got John Giles for you before 10 a.m. this morning and the crappy quiz shortly as well. But we are back with the view from the Springboks with Stephen Kisby Green.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
You're welcome back at 9:07. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Now, it is time to get the South African view on everything that's been happening over the last couple of days. Stephen Kisby Green, our very own Stephen Kisby Green, is with us. Stephen, how are you?
How's it guys? How's it going?
All good. All good. A massive reaction to you setting the scene last week before the first test, and tensions started to get a little bit high over the course of the last week. Tensions that perhaps you stoked seeped into the Springbok camp, and all of a sudden your beloved director of rugby is here in Vimeo giving us a 1 hour breakdown of what went wrong last week. What the hell has Razzie Erasmus done here?
It's a mark of pure genius, if you ask me. I think he's, like, regardless of whether or not you think it's the right thing and whether or not you think his calling out the referees is right or not, it is the perfect distraction. It is exactly what this Lions tour needed, if you ask me.
Why do the South Africans need a distraction? Are they not world champions? Should they not have the confidence to say, we don't need any sideshows like this?
Well, see, the thing is, they're not the same team that won the World Cup in 2019. And I made the mistake last week of thinking that they were based off of that SAA performance. This is a team with a head coach who's never head coached before, coming into his second, now his third test match ever. It was supposed to have another one before this, and then the second Georgia test got cancelled. So he's not necessarily the best in terms of managing the media in these amazingly crucial, huge, high-pressure scenarios. Then you've got Siya Kolisi, who was coming into the series on a little bit of poor form, gained a little bit more form when he moved to the Sharks, but still wasn't in his top form. You've got the likes of Jasper Visser, who's starting his first ever test match, and he didn't need that extra pressure on him coming into this incredibly crucial, like, the series is on the line type of thing. So to take all of the media pressure, I mean, all those things are coming into this final, or this what feels like a final test match for the Box. It's not really, it's only the second. But it kind of is, because it's a do or die match, and yet the only thing we're talking about is some guy with some random guy on Twitter who may or may not be Razzie Erasmus, and then Razzie Erasmus going literally out of control and doing it. The thing is, Razzie's never out of control, though. I don't think.
Yeah,
he's never given the impression that he does anything that he doesn't want to do.
Exactly. And that's why this has been all so very strange, because if this was anybody that wasn't Razzie, you might have said, well, this is just crazy. And I don't think we've ever used that adjective to describe Razzie Erasmus. He's been one of the most... He's certainly been ruthless behind closed doors. He's been cold, I'd imagine, plenty of times. But this unhinged nature we haven't seen before. And I think the madness, there's a method to it, is what you're trying to say this morning. But I'm hearing a lot of excuses there, Stephen, in terms of why things haven't gone so well. So a rookie head coach, a captain maybe who's undercooked. I mean, he's coming up against a test captain whose shoulder was out of place there only a couple of weeks ago. Is there not any pride there within you who's like, no, these guys just underperformed last week. They can do a hell of a lot better. This coach should be getting a better tune out of this set of players than the one we got last Saturday.
No, I think you misunderstood. Those weren't excuses. Those were reasons why the Box would be under pressure. The Box bottled it in that second half in last week. And to be honest, I didn't think they were particularly impressive in the first half either. They just were better than the Lions. And the Lions improved drastically in their second half. But again, as I think Alan Quinlan mentioned as well, it was not a great test match. It was tense, sure, but it wasn't the best. It wasn't what we were looking for. It wasn't what we were hoping for. And the Box know that they need to improve. They know that that wasn't their best. And yeah, the distractions from Rossi, who's not in really, I don't really know the structure of the management setup at the moment, but Jacques Nienaber is the head coach. So he will be doing most of the one-on-one sessions. So Rossi can take the distractions away and lure all the media away and let the box just carry on and do their thing. Mm. And that's, yeah, I think, what they need. They don't need people interrogating them on every single thing this week. They just need to buckle down and improve.
He might be doing all that sort of at the expense of his own, I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but like not quite his own career. But I mean, this is going to be, if Springboks lose this weekend, Stephen, this is going to look really bad on Erasmus.
I think it's going to look bad on Erasmus no matter what happens. It's as Ellen Quinnan mentioned earlier, it is unprecedented. It is not something that you would do lightly. But at the same time, it also stirs the pot. And a lot of people have been saying that we've needed something like this with referees for a while. I'm not saying that every referee decision is wrong. Of course not. And most matches, there's always going to be that little bit of 50-50 calls going one way or the other. But there's always, but there has been a trend where big decisions have been made and nobody's been held accountable to them. And so I don't necessarily agree with what Rossi's done personally. I think it's a mark of genius. I think it's absolutely brilliant theater, but the way he's publicly calling out might not be the best thing for the game, but just to get those questions and the stirring those pots about how we look at getting referees to be held to account, I think that was needed. So Rossi might have sacrificed himself. Rossi's effectively made himself a martyr in this series. Mm.
Yeah, I just think you do all of that away from the heat of battle. Like just doing it in the middle of maybe it's an absolutely calculated market genius. But look at it. We'll move on to talk about the game. But I do think that I think that if the Springboks end up losing this weekend, I think that I don't know where he go. Where does he go from then? Like if somebody comes in from the side and doesn't get penalised from the line side, if Tom Curry comes in again and hits somebody in the leg when they should be hitting them higher up, where does he go from here? Like it's the red button for me. I just think that if the Springboks lose this weekend, and I actually think there's every chance that they won't, but if they do, there's a chance that this leaves a very dark stain on his career.
Yeah, I agree with you there. It's going to be, it's good. I mean, the next week will be more interesting than this week. And this week has been, I can't even really remember that it was six, that there was only 6 days ago that we had a test match. Like how long has this week been?
Well, we haven't been able to talk about the rugby, Stephen. That's the difficulty. We've been, you know, he's been tweeting again this morning. He's at it nonstop, keeping us in entertainment. And like we're bread and circus. We're like Egypt's. We're falling for it. We're like the seals, sort of give us a little bit more fish there. We're keeping coming. We are sort of lapping it up, obviously.
There's nothing else really to do. I mean, again, it's a mark of brilliance because Rossi doesn't want the media talking about how poor the box were. He wants to talk about, oh, the referees, or he wants to talk about me, or he wants to talk about Warren Gatland putting pressure on Marius Jonker. Mm. He's trying to avoid how bad the box were.
Are we going to get like a more entertaining fare from South Africa? Are you going to at least entertain us this week in any shape or form, Stephen?
Hopeful. The inclusion of Visa is interesting to me. It sort of goes in. We're looking to play a little bit more like we played in the World Cup final as opposed to the World Cup semi-final. That another thing is what gets me is a lot in the Irish sort of analysis of South African rugby is, oh, they do one thing and one thing really well. And yet, if you really look at the performance between the semi-final and the final, they weren't exactly the same. And it looked like they were trying to do more of that, more of the running rugby in the second half in the first test, but they just ran out of steam. They just had no fitness. I think they're going to try that again this week. If they win, if they dominate physically in the first half, then in the second half, they're going to open up wide a bit more. But I don't think they can fix fitness in a week. So they're going to try it. Maybe try spread out a bit wider earlier. But I don't know. It's going to be, I'm expecting a little bit more like what we saw on Saturday.
Right. Well, Stephen, enjoy it. And thanks a million for being with us this morning.
Cheers, lads.
That's Stephen Kisby-Green, resident OTB Springbok nut. We'll be checking in on him again next week after the Lions go 2-0 up, of course, which is going to be good. It's going to be an absolute cracker of a game tomorrow, regardless. Personally, I absolutely love the the brutishness that we saw last week. I think that there are such high stakes that you don't necessarily need entertainment from the game in the traditional manner that entertainment is usually dished out. I think the intensity of the battle is enough entertainment for us. And a reminder as well that as part of all of this and as part of the nine matches we are broadcasting from the British and Irish Lions Tour South Africa and Off the Ball, we will be bringing you live commentary of Saturday's second test against the Springboks. Brian O'Driscoll is joining Neil Tracy for commentary with Keith Wood on analysis also. And our Lions coverage is brought to you in association with Vodafone, lead partner of the British and Irish Lions. At 16 minutes past nine on this Friday morning, it is time for the Crappy Quiz.
Chris Martin.
Oh, you're kidding me.
September.
Kyle Lafferty.
Are you joking me?
Is that right?
I know. Is that right?
Anybody else?
Leash, was it?
Like, that is one of the most stupid questions.
Darius Vassell? Seriously, you all need to just stay quiet. This is getting really annoying doing this quiz.
What is going on here?
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome along to the shoutiest segment on Irish radio. It's the scintillating, it's the stupefying, it's the splendido crappy quiz. Every Friday we pit three of Team Off the Ball up against each other in our no-holds-barred quiz of sporting factoids at the end of the week. Allow me to welcome today's contestants. Our first contestant today woke up in the middle of the night and hacked into the mainframe of ODB Towers to change the name of the podcast from the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy to the Tommy Rooney Pod and Friends. He knows he's not a third wheel. He's the Ronaldo to their Rooney and Tevez. Give it up for the Meath Hill Billy, Tommy Rooney.
Thank you very much, Owen. Finally, some credit.
You're welcome. It's a great podcast and front and centre is Tommy Rooney. Check it out. It's on the ODB Sports app. Our next contestant today is heading for the Department of Sport this afternoon to throw prawn sandwiches at the Minister in outrage over the news that there will be no free tickets and no corporate boxes at Dublin versus Mayo in a few weeks' time. We didn't go through 16 months of pain for this. Give it up for the Beast of Ballyhaunis, Nathan Nate Dog Murphy.
No corporate boxes. What's COVID got against corporate boxes?
I don't know.
I'm doubly vaccinated. I just got my second vaccine yesterday. My joy was that I'd be pretty much bomb-proof ahead of the All-Ireland semi-final.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible. I am speculating here, but I presume our outdoor summer...
Oh, well, here.
Our outdoor summer would involve not having a corporate box because, I mean, part of the attraction is getting to go indoors at halftime, Nathan. You wouldn't be watching the primary game or anything like that. You want to get indoors, get a nice pint in a glass. To be honest, that just sounds... That actually, who wouldn't want that? I mean, I said that as if that was like some sort of thing or something, but no, that's what everybody would want.
What's your point?
I rest my case on that front. Our last contestant today might not be in a fit state to partake in a quiz because he's already eaten all the weekend's cheese and drank all the wine while watching Razzie's referee rant on loop. He is more pumped than a Springbok forward for this weekend. It is, of course, Adrian, who's your daddy, Barry.
Morning, everybody. Hope everybody's well. Great to see you.
Great
looking forward to this.
Yeah.
How are the birthday celebrations, Adrian?
Happy belated birthday,
Nathan,
Adrian.
Nathan, yeah.
44. So 45.
Well,
45.
Listen,
I thought 44.
No. 44. Easy does it.
Oh, sorry.
As somebody pointed out on YouTube yesterday, and like, let's face it, we all pay a lot of attention to what our lovely YouTube commenters say. They said I look very well in 44. So that was kind of everybody nice. Was speaking to yesterday.
So are you the elder statesman of Off the Ball? You're the oldest
No,
25 staff members. You're the oldest.
No.
Are you sure? I think you are.
100% positive.
I can't think of anybody
who
else.
Who do you think might be older than me? I'm struggling.
I can't think of anyone.
Well, there is one person older than me, so...
Who is the person?
Give us a clue.
I mean, lads.
Does he present OTB AM?
Yes, he does.
All right. So Jer's older than Adrian.
No!
Is he?
Yes. I didn't know that.
Fact.
No, he denies that.
And he denies it, which is absolutely ridiculous. He is older than me.
And like, what is your secret for looking so good at 44?
Just a lot of moisturizers.
Somewhere people's birthdays come up.
There's moisturizers.
Moisturizer through the years, yeah. Okay. Like a very, I would always take a very clean living approach on. I'd be very careful with what I eat and drink. A lot of exercise, a lot of fresh air, sea swimming every morning. Just general
expensive wine,
healthy
approach.
Healthy body on.
Nice.
My approach.
Do ginger people age at a slower rate?
That's disgusting. This is why we pre-record the crappy quiz, to get rid of bigoted comments like this. Absolutely horrendous stuff. Nathan Murphy, cancelled. As ever, the format is a classic crappy quiz with a series of questions on a range of themes. Then it's on to the slip and slide of trivia, which is the rapid fire round. You can podcast a crappy quiz on otbsports.com or the OTB Sports app. And if you're watching on YouTube, make sure to click the thumbs up. Please send any questions you have to us via postcard to Crappy Quiz Quizmaster, Off the Ball Towers, Marconi House, Diggs Lane, Dublin 2. Round one is the boring questions round, never multiple choice. Tommy, question one for you. Flora Duffy was one of a number of successful Olympians this week who we as Irish people tried to claim as our own. What country did she win her gold medal for?
You see, the great thing about Tommy's absolutely screwed at the quiz these days at anything topical, because unless it's to do with the football pod, Tommy has no interest. No, the Olympics have passed him by completely.
And I wouldn't mind, this is one of the most spoken about things of the week.
I know, and I feel like it's not shocked. It's not as obvious as it in my head. Is it Germany?
Oh
no.
God. Bermuda.
Bermuda, Tommy. Bermuda, their first gold medal.
That's very, very poor. Very poor.
Nathan, question one for you.
You're right, I am in trouble.
Joe Canning will be remembered for many things, not least for tearing Cork apart in Semple way back in the 2008 Championship. What did he score that day? And I will accept 1 point either side of the correct total.
Ah, lads.
Listen, I'm taking a Joe Canning approach to this quiz, and I'm wondering why I should answer any of Owen Sheehan's questions. But if you come back to me at lunchtime and there's some better journalists around, I'll tell them all the answers.
This is one of the, like,
most... 2-11?
No.
2-11, I'll give it to you.
No!
It was 3-8!
No, it wasn't.
2-12.
It was 2-12, Tommy.
Oh, it was 2-12, okay.
Like, somebody accused me last week of not knowing the answers to everybody else's questions, so there you go. If he got the incorrect answer on, you can't give him a dig. Seriously.
No, I have to, like...
Oh, come on.
Because if
Tommy had said, oh, you know, somewhere around, like, you know, the Caribbean...
The triangle, some triangle.
It's not right, like, come on. He's actually just not right. How come...
But it's disputed. It's disputed because, you know, people say 2-12, but Hawkeye wasn't in operation. One thing is clearly why.
No, it's not disputed. He scored 2-12. It's a point of fact.
It depends what newspaper you look at.
Adrian.
This is ludicrous, honestly. Like, we're now giving out points for incorrect answers. Well, that's great. That's like a Razzie Erasmus. I'm looking forward to my incorrect answer here and getting a point for it.
Adrian, the last time the Lions played South Africa in the second test of a tour, there were 7 Irishmen in the starting team. Can you name 5 of them? See, I accept partial answers, Adrian.
Softballed.
If you give me one wrong name, though, I'll have to sound a buzzer.
Well, no, I mean, I can just give you 5 wrong names and then that's a correct answer by our existing logic.
Listen, rugby man,
You just go, you lads go for a nap now in the middle of the afternoon and I'll give whoever owns the company.
Most famous Lions games. If only we had one of the stars.
Brian O'Driscoll.
Full hour, honest.
That's one.
Paul O'Connell.
That's 2.
Rob Kearney.
That's 3. Brilliant performance that day. Come on, I'm going to need to up the pace here a little bit.
Players who started, isn't it?
John Hayes would have been in that team.
No, we're going to have to sound a buzzer for that.
Well, no, I think I'd take one wrong and then...
No. We can't do that. It was just...
You've embarrassed yourself.
I had to, like, actually kind of process that sentence there.
Tommy Bow was my next answer. Tommy Bow. Put me back on track.
Tommy Bow would have been correct. And who got their eye gouged out within the first few minutes?
Ferris.
No, Luke Fitzgerald. So it's Rob Kearney, Luke Fitzgerald, Tommy Bow, Brian O'Driscoll, David Wallace, Jamie Heaslip and Paul O'Connell. And that would have been your 7.
Oh, you've let yourself down there, pal.
I wouldn't mind have taken an incorrect on that if they were the rules we were actually playing by. But
well, you know, look, this is the way it goes. And Nathan, congratulations. You were 1-0 up after the first round. Really happy for you.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Round 2 is the Cork round. We have to give the county their due after delivering another great national sporting moment this week. In this round, the questions will all be about Cork sports people. Tommy, if Ronan O'Gara is the most capped Cork man in Irish rugby history, who is the second most capped?
Donnacho Collin?
Oh, he rushed in. He's in third. It is Stringer, yeah. I actually would have gone for Donnacho as well. I think Donnacho finished on 94, Stringer finished on 98. So no dice, Tommy. Nathan, who was the first Cork person to win an Olympic medal representing Ireland?
I don't think he even made the shortlist for Boog's Mount Rushmore back last year.
Listen, Tommy, will you zip it?
It kind of is a clue what you said there, I guess.
Sorry, medal or gold medal?
Who? Any medal.
Oh.
Anytime now, Nathan.
Well, the question has just changed in the last couple of
seconds. So, it has not changed. It's really, he was the first Cork person to win an Olympic medal representing Ireland.
Now, what other country would they be representing?
Britain, because owned by Britain for 800 long years.
You don't know the answer, so you're not going to get it. That's what we're talking about here. So let's move on.
Do I go for, this is not my answer, do I go for a Bob Tisdale or do I just go Rob Heffernan?
It's not Rob Heffernan. Sure, Sonia won a medal before Rob Heffernan.
Oh, Jesus.
Pat O'Callaghan is correct, yeah.
Oh, no. I didn't think Pat O'Callaghan was from Cork.
Yeah. Born in Bantyre.
Jesus, come on, Adrian. There's some bio.
Yeah, so I'm just putting, somebody said last week that I don't, despite the fact that I always say I can get everybody else's questions right, not my own, I'm just putting that to bed, Tommy, this morning.
Adrian. Did you have Stringer? No.
Adrian. Mm-hmm.
Did you have Stringer?
Adrian, who?
Yeah.
Who was the last Cork person to win an Olympic medal before Paul O'Donovan and Fintan McCarthy on Thursday morning?
Oh, jeez.
Go again?
Who was the last Cork person to win an Olympic medal before Paul O'Donovan and Fintan McCarthy on Thursday morning?
Who was the last Cork person to win? Well, it was Paul O'Donovan and Gary O'Donovan.
No, it wasn't. It was Emily Hegarty on Wednesday morning in the women's four.
Oh, that was nasty.
Oh,
that was gnarly. That was like, that's there again, you see.
I'd be upset with the quizmaster and his officiating for that one. That was, why? That was cheap.
No, that's very difficult. I'm getting a different level question. Very difficult. Here. I really am.
They're literally plastered all over the front of all the papers. And Cork having another rower to get us off the mark with the bronze 100%. Medal on Wednesday. Yeah. Round three is another Olympics round. I didn't give this round a name. Tommy, question three for you. Which of the following Olympic sports did not originate in Japan? A, taekwondo, B, judo, or C, karate?
Just give me the question one more time.
Which of the following Olympic sports did not originate in Japan? A, taekwondo, B, judo, or C, karate?
I really like the way you say taekwondo. It's like a cup of tea, taekwondo. Is it taekwondo or is it taekwondo?
Will you just give me an answer? Nathan currently leading 1-0, by the way.
Oh, wait, sorry. It's a bit of a trick question, isn't it? Karate.
No, it's not. Karate originated in Japan. Taekwondo is the one. Taekwondo is Korean.
Why did you think it was a trick question, Tommy?
Because karate was obvious.
He thought it wasn't an Olympic sport or something, I'd say. Or something along those lines. It is now. It's back in the Olympics. Nathan, which of the following words is not included in the Olympic Games slogan? A, faster, B, higher, or C, further?
Further.
Correct. When I read that out loud, that was actually quite easy.
Honestly, is this some sort of softball? Are we getting set up here, Tommy?
I'm not going to lie, I didn't
Doesn't
read
it
that.
Feel that way.
I didn't read that.
Set up to lose again.
Faster, stronger, further. What the hell?
By the way,
I've had pretty easy questions.
You've been getting. I came home, I got up early this morning in the expectation I'd get to take Phil Egan down a peg or two after the nonsense I had to watch.
You left your pajamas, t-shirt on you, and you threw yourself in front of the camera.
After I had to watch.
Don't stand up, Nathan.
Phil is on his
holidays. I'm wearing pants for once.
Adrian.
Phil's on his holidays.
Adrian, how fast was Ben Johnson's disqualified world record at Seoul 1988? Was it A, 9.59, B, 9.69, or C, 9.79?
9.69.
Oh, he jumps in beforehand.
9.79!
It's 9.79, Adrian Barry.
I thought it was
9.69
before you said a word, so I couldn't.
Adrian, you can only blame yourself.
You're humiliating yourself.
Think about Olympic events, right? You have to go faster, obviously, in races. You have to go higher in different events. Where do you have to go further, Tommy? Makes no sense.
Javelin, discus, shot put.
I can't. I can only look at myself, Adrian. I can't be looking at other people's performances.
Here we go. Here's the football pod nonsense coming out again.
Round four. Round four is the Fun Free Magic. This is a disgrace. Like, I mean, it's just so awful, the excuse making. Right. This is the Fun Free Magic number round, and it's certainly been a fun free quiz. Contestants get three points for getting the number exactly right. If no one manages that, the nearest contestant who doesn't go bust gets 2 points. The second closest gets 1 point. I'm going to say that we can only accept the answer that's written on your paper. I'm also going to have to ask for your pens once the music ends. So if you don't mind, give us the following number. The number of consecutive All-Ireland Football Championships that Dublin have won in women's football at the moment, plus the number of years between the previous defeat and last week's defeat for the men's USA basketball team at the Olympic Games, plus the number of points Dublin had to spare in their win over Mayo in the 2020 All-Ireland Football Final, plus the number of goals Raheem Sterling scored at Euro 2020. Your 30 seconds expire when Sinatra sings Bright Shiny Beads. So the number of consecutive All-Ireland Championships that Dublin have won in women's football, plus the number of years between defeats for the men's basketball team for the United States at the Olympics. So they lost last week. How many years was it since their last defeat? The number of points Dublin beat Mayo by in the All-Ireland last year. And then how many goals did Sterling score at Euro 2020? Adrian, what have you got?
18.
18. Tommy?
27.
27? Was it 27 or 7?
27.
Nathan?
Sounded a bit excited there when Tommy said 27, so I'm thinking maybe I should say 27. Well, I think I might have gone one too many, but I'm going to go 29.
Well, I can tell you the answer is 29.
Oh!
Yes!
Yes.
Nathan has opened up an unassailable lead at this point. He's gone 5-0 up after that. Dublin, run us through them, Nathan. Dublin have won how many in a row?
Three.
Four.
Four.
This is we've been set up here, Tommy. Is it four?
Yeah, they've got 16,
17, 18, 19.
Four in a row. The USA basketball team went 17 years. Yeah, Athens was the last time they lost. Dublin beat Mayo by 5 points.
I had 6 points.
And Sterling scored three goals at Euro 2020.
That's where I thought I'd
29. We are on to the finals.
I'm beginning to understand the Razzie Erasmus mindset now. I'm going to get up in Vimeo later on.
What's the score here?
5-0.
5-0.
Oh, Jesus.
Our winner tonight will be decided in the round that separates the men from the boys, the Paul O'Donovan's from the Paul Hewson's. It's a no thing.
Can I just say whoever is working on this show, shut up. Can I just say whoever is working on the show, I want a Nathan Murphy masterclass put up on social media after this that I saw for Phil Egan last week when he got a question wrong.
So annoying.
At the end,
I was on at least three meetings with Nathan last week where this came up and dominated for about a half an hour every time.
But it was put up as if, oh, he's run through and got every question right. Where it turned out, he got one wrong.
You know the rules at this stage. You're
as
that YouTube commenter says, Nathan Murphy is just insufferable. Going second is Adrian. So Adrian won the tie break. So it's Nathan, then Adrian, then Tommy. But of course, Nathan is going to show that he's as good as Phil Egan and get all of these questions correct and not let anybody else in.
No, sure, I've already won. I can relax.
Yeah, okay, well, let's see. I mean, true champions wouldn't just relax, would they?
I really hope, Tommy, we can do this.
you ready, Nathan?
Honestly. Oh, I'm always ready.
Okay, your time starts now. Which horse won this year's Cheltenham Gold Cup?
Album follow.
No, Manila Indo. Nat Wayne was knocked out of the badminton tournament in Tokyo by a player from which country?
Taipei.
Correct. Troy Parrott has joined which club on loan?
Time.
MK Dons too slow. Who did Joe Canning beat in his final to win his All-Ireland, Tommy?
Waterford.
Correct. Sunisa Lee won a gold medal this week in what sport?
Say it again, who?
Sunisa Lee won a gold medal in what sport?
Dressage.
No, gymnastics. Did Seamus Coleman make his Everton debut in 2009 or 2010, Nathan? Dressage.
2009.
Correct.
That's the corner of the meat message.
Nathan Murphy wins again. Congratulations, Nathan. On a sad little life.
What was the last question
was, what year did Joe Canning or Seamus Coleman make his debut for Everton? It's 2009.
Dressage.
Dressage. I mean, listen, I probably wouldn't get a supercut until Tommy said dressage.
Right, Nathan Murphy, well done. We'll get Phil Egan back with you when he's back from holidays.
Great.
That has been the crappy quiz. Thank you so much for putting up absolutely no fight whatsoever, Tommy and Adrian. But thank you for taking part all the same.
Our YouTubers will know.
ODBAM brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. You can stay tuned to OTB across the day. There is so much coming up because you've got on OTB Sports Radio, we've got Friday Night Racing from 3 o'clock, the Olympic show from 5 o'clock, and OTB live on your radio from 7 o'clock. On Saturday's OTB, we'll have the latest from the Olympics. There's live commentary of the Lions' second test with Brian O'Driscoll, plus updates and reaction from the hurling and the football. On Sunday's OTB, Paddy Andrews is at the Leinster final for us. The Sunday paper review will be on, and there's all the latest from the Olympic Games as well.